Call the House Interim Committee on Judiciary to order September 12th, 2012. Senator Cruz.
I'd like to call the meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order as well.
First agenda item is evidence-based scientific policing. Greg Campbell is going to be here in place of Greg Prinz. Do you want to bring your crew up?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Kevin, it's close.
One of the Campbells.
Yeah, similar type personalities.
Kevin, do you want to come up?
There's more here than the other.
Good morning, Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Chair Cruz, and members of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. It's my privilege this morning to get us started this morning on your first subject matter for the day, and that's evidence-based policing. So I want to begin just by thanking the committee for bringing this concept up. Evidence-based practices are a common focus with the legislature, but this morning we're really going to take a look at it in terms of the policing environment. And so I want to thank you for making that a priority this morning for your committee. I want to thank Mr. Craig Prinz and the Criminal Justice Commission for bringing Jim Bierman here this morning, who I will introduce shortly. I want to thank him for putting together a collaborative combination of local and state police partners for this discussion, and for inviting faculty members from the criminology departments of Western Oregon, Southern Oregon, and Portland State University. Now, in the course of the conversation this morning, we want to take a closer look at a rising paradigm that evidence-based policing can mean less crime. We believe science is reliable. We arrive at one overarching question. How do we translate the science of policing of Oregon to Oregon's generally small police departments? We have a unique policing environment. Now, I'd like to introduce Jim Bierman to me. He's not going to be the first presenter, but I'm going to go ahead and introduce him to you this morning. And then I'm going to introduce Chief John Teague, who's sitting to my right. He'll begin the conversation. And I'd like to begin just by introducing briefly Jim Bierman. Chief Bierman is not an academic. He's actually a practitioner. As you know from his title, he was a chief of police and served in most recently in the Redlands, California Police Department. It's an interesting department, and it's roughly the size of the Salem Police Department, so you get a feel for the scale of that department. In California, of course, there's a number of far larger departments, but he's walked in the shoes of some of the policing executives that serve in similar size departments here in Oregon. I just mentioned he's not an academic, but he is well respected in that environment. He's the first police chief to be inducted as an honorary fellow in the Academy of Experimental Criminology and into the Halls of Fame at George Mason University's Center for Evidence-Based Crime Policy and the School of Behavioral Science at California State University, San Bernardino. He's currently an executive fellow with the National Institute of Justice, and he's a senior fellow at George Mason University. Perhaps most interesting, next Monday morning, Chief Bierman assumes the helm as CEO of the Police Foundation. It's a national, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to supporting innovation and improvement in policing through its research, professional services, technical assistance, and communication programs. So we're glad to have him here, and we appreciate his willingness to make the trip. I've had a chance to talk with Chief Bierman, and he's a very qualified person to lead the discussion this morning. Before you listen to Chief Bierman, I'd like to introduce the committee again to Chief John Teague. He was before you recently to discuss the concept of eyewitness identification and some of the challenges facing policing and the work we're doing to create model policies there. He led a work group effort, chiefs, sheriffs, district attorneys, and other stakeholders in order to craft a policy that really addresses that issue. So policing is on the front edge of that. But Chief Teague is the police chief of a small city, relatively, in the state of Oregon, but it's very representative of how policing occurs here. His department in Dallas has a population of about 16,000, and he has about 18 sworn officers. That's a very typical size policing operation. But I think as you listen to Chief Teague, you'll be as pleased as I always am representing the chiefs with the kind of quality leaders we have in departments that are smaller but no less, run by CEOs and chiefs that really care about their policing and are actively involved and want to be better at what they do. So as you listen to Chief Teague, I'm sure you'll hear that flavor. He's someone that I find a very smart and dedicated police chief, and I'm going to turn it over to Chief Teague to give you a smaller police department perspective before Chief Jim Bierman comes in. And Chief Bierman will come up immediately following Chief Teague, and so let me thank the committee. I'm going to excuse myself and thank the committee for taking the subject. Thank you. Chief Teague.
Thank you. Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and committee members, my name is John Teague. Thank you for allowing me, the chief of a small police agency, to speak to you quite briefly on the value of evidence-based policing. We know what evidence-based practices are. With, for example, the passage of Senate Bill 267, evidence-based practices have become an important part of Oregon's criminal justice landscape. But evidence-based policing is a much smaller slice of that pie, one that's not been given a whole lot of attention until recently. Evidence-based policing is a relatively new field of research, and much of what we know about cops and their effectiveness in reducing crime is learned by studying police officers who work at larger agencies. And this makes sense, because larger agencies have the resources, including the data, to contribute to scientific, rigorous research. As budgets remain tight, as we expect government to prove itself, and as we police officers have become more professional and more educated, it's easy to agree with those who suggest that we're on a steady march towards a steady diet of evidence-based practices in police work. And that's a good thing. For example, solid, reliable research tells us that we reduce crime and recidivism when cops focus their attention on repeat offenders. That seems intuitive, but because we now know that it works, we've grown more comfortable seeking out and contacting likely offenders before they offend, directing resources from patrol to monitor likely offenders or crime hotspots, and expending resources on the front end of a problem, even when we know there will be no measurable output to defend that expenditure. That is, we can't measure crime that doesn't happen, but we can defend our work based upon good research. Solid, reliable research also tells us that neighborhood watch programs don't correlate with a reduction in crime in high crime areas. Armed with that knowledge, we still meet with neighbors, but we no longer see neighborhood watch as an end in itself. Solid, reliable research also tells us that arresting juveniles for minor offenses correlates with them becoming more delinquent than if police use their discretion to merely warn them or seek an alternative to formal charges. One more. This one is especially encouraging. When street cops are respectful and professional in their dealings with bad guys, the bad guys are less likely to recidivate and crime goes down. Now that seems intuitive to some of us and counterintuitive to others, but good science indicates that the professionalization of street cops, including the respectful treatment of people who aren't respectable, pays off for everyone involved, including the people who won't be future victims. There's a common thread through the studies I've just mentioned, and it's this. My knowledge of them came only through my reading of academic and quasi-academic literature. I appeared before you last spring when we discussed eyewitness identification. Eyewitness ID shares that same thread. The U.S. Department of Justice published a study recommending reform as long ago as 1999, but it took a long, long time before reform dipped down to the local level, and only then after the large agencies began to make changes. And this defines the problem that's important to me as a small agency chief and as a cop who cares how we today set the course for law enforcement tomorrow. The processes by which police agencies adopt innovative, proven police practices is far from random. According to the National Research Council, more cosmopolitan agencies are the early adopters, followed by mid-size and large agencies. Then it's not until an idea or a method has become accepted and normalized that small agencies begin to take notice. Studies have indicated the reason this process strongly favors mid and large agencies. It's because those agencies have the resources to pay attention to the research, and they have the personnel whose task is to ferret out those good ideas, to confer with similarly situated agencies, and to champion the adoption of innovation that works. Of course, we small agencies, having fewer resources, want and need to spend those resources wisely, and proven evidence-based police practices allow us to do that, if we know about them and if we're comfortable adopting them. Money spent on proven methods of policing is money spent well, and money spent familiarizing agency heads with those proven methods is also money spent well. We need at least one thing, and it'd be good to have another. What would be good to have is a closer working relationship with the Oregon University System's criminology researchers, some of whom are nationally known and nationally respected. Oregon also has an abundance of forward-leaning small agencies. Cultivating those relationships around evidence-based police practices is one example where the state can leverage dollars to reduce crime and recidivism. What we need is a restoration of executive-level and supervisor training and education at DPSST. Law enforcement journals and trade organizations can't do a thorough enough job compelling small agencies to be early adopters of innovative, evidence-based methods of policing, because doing so requires dedicated personnel and resources, informed conversation, and the authority to move the discussion. However, DPSST can fill that gap. The Police Academy is in a position to survey the research landscape, to promote discussions among agency leaders and supervisors, to solicit research where it's lacking, and to move Oregon law enforcement from the standard reactive model to a model that focuses on outcomes, not outputs, in which the evidence shows works. As it is for other disciplines, the adoption of evidence-based practices is good for Oregon law enforcement, it's good for our budgets and yours, and it's good for those who would otherwise commit or be victims of crimes. Thank you.
Any committee members have any questions? Mr. Salter?
Mr. Chair, thank you. There's some freedom in not coming back here, because I tell you the truth, when I was a youngster, I had some encounters with some fine law enforcement officers, and the fact that they didn't arrest me probably would save me, but they were very respectful, and you know, they just sat there and talked to us when we were young guys and said, don't be an idiot, essentially. And well, my question, though, is the rank and file, like, we don't have anybody that I see or knowingly see from the rank and file. Do they like this stuff, the men and women out there on the beat that are actually doing this? Not that you're not, but...
Yeah. I'm surprised by the enthusiasm. When they know that something works, I'm surprised by the enthusiasm, the ready acceptance of it. I can't speak for all of them, but I can speak for those with whom I work, yes.
Chief Teague, I find it interesting that you mentioned that one of the measurements that you're using is respect and professionalism, and that you say that it pays off. I mean, it just seems like that's, you'd almost kind of walk away saying that's a no-brainer, you know, and that seems like it's always been the rule of the thumb to go by, but for you to now to incorporate that into kind of a policy and a mindset to go there with what evidence-based policing is all about as just a component. Wow. For us to have to grab that and say, well, that's true. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I'm not quite sure I follow you, but I'll respond and you redirect me if you need to. The difference is we know that it works. We know that simply arresting people, being knuckle draggers, if you will, we know that that does not pay off as well as being a professional, respectful, respectable police officer. We know that now. It seems intuitive that we would lean that direction, but as you know, for decades and decades, that wasn't the model. That is the model we're going towards now. So it seems intuitive, but now we know that it works. And that's huge, because every dollar counts. And when we push towards a certain direction, you know, some accuse it of being a softer method of policing. Well, maybe it is a bit softer, but we know that it works.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Courtney?
You said something that startled me. I'm just going to quote from your testimony. It would be good to have a closer working relationship with the Oregon University System's criminology researchers, some of whom are nationally known and nationally respected. Didn't they talk about abundance of forward-leaning small agencies, which I don't think relates to that statement. You talk about something else, even though you combine the same paragraph. I just want to talk about higher ed. What's that all about?
Well, Chief Bierman will speak to that at length. Can we continue or defer to him?
I just am startled by it, because it just catches me by surprise.
Well, it's interesting. It's the academics that do the research.
I understand that.
Sure.
So you're not working with them at all?
Well, there's a great gulf fixed between academics and we practitioners.
You say academics. Which schools are you talking about?
Well, across the nation.
So you're not talking to Oregon. You're just talking generally across the nation. You're not specifically talking to Oregon?
Well, I am speaking to Oregon. I'll speak personally with regard to Oregon. I have a working relationship with the criminology department at Western Oregon University. You know, Dallas and Monmouth are neighbors, so I have that relationship established. We do work together. We are looking forward to doing research together.
Right. That's okay. What I'm surprised. I thought that was going on, and this implies it isn't.
It is rare that it occurs between academics and practitioners. It is a rare event.
But it's not rare it's going on at Western Oregon. Or is it?
It is not going on at Western Oregon yet. Terry Gingerich and I have that relationship, yes. Yeah, Western Oregon is moving that direction. Dallas PD is moving that direction.
Just for the record, Chair, the new president of the University of Oregon, his PhD is in criminology. He's world renowned, just so you know that. I don't mean to promote the University of Oregon's new president, but he has that background, which startled me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anyone else? Senator Cruz?
Thank you. To some degree, are we going across purposes? I was thinking back when I was younger. A friend of mine who had been out partying on a weekend was stopped by a county deputy, and he had been imbibing in adult beverages, and the deputy just said, you know, he was 3 miles from home, he said, just go home, don't, okay. But what we have done with drunk driving now, it's almost incumbent to cite. And I'm thinking of this friend of mine not having anything on his record. Probably was a good thing long term, and he doesn't do that sort of thing anymore. And so I'm wondering, are we, when we're ramping up on one end and trying to be more flexible on the other, are we kind of going across purposes here a little bit?
Senator Cruz, thank you for allowing some clarity. Evidence-based police practices do not encourage us to be soft on crime. I used that phrase earlier, somewhat reluctantly, you might have observed. But we are not looking at all to be soft on crime. However, the vast majority of what cops do is not fighting crime. We deal with what the academics are calling maintenance of social order. Of course, one of the tools in our handbags is law enforcement, certainly. And we wield that stick strongly. In the case of DUIs, you know, I'm surprised to hear that in these days there are cops that are stopping people and telling them just to continue on down the road.
And this was 40 years ago.
Okay, got it. That makes much more sense.
Okay.
But evidence-based policing should not be correlated with being soft on crime. Now, with regard to juveniles especially, we do know that being hard on juveniles correlates with more crime, with a harder row for them to hoe, if you will. In the juvenile justice industry, further down the line from cops, they're struggling with how to keep juveniles out of the juvenile justice system. The schools are struggling with how to deal with expelling them and forcing them into the juvenile justice system. We're all concerned for these matters, as are we cops.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's just, I understand that, and I agree with the fact that people have a bump with the law, and they can learn a lesson without having to go into the system. Once you're in the system, things kind of change for you. So, I'm talking about especially for juveniles. Like the movie years ago, Scared Straight, that really impacted a whole lot of kids who might have been on the verge, and a lot of them said, we don't want to go down that path. And so I'm trying to figure out, because clearly the cops do have discretion at some point, I wonder if we're citing, especially DUI, I mean, that is just, it's become totally black and white, I think, and I'm wondering if we have kind of gone overboard maybe a little bit, or do your folks on the street say, well...
You're overboard with being too strict on things like DUIs?
Yeah.
Well, as you know, a lot of that is culturally and politically driven.
Right.
Right.
That's my point. We have driven to a point where maybe we are removing some discretion that being caught might have to say, this kid doesn't belong, you know, I mean, that sort of thing, so.
Well, right, and that's one value to the research.
Right.
We now know that when cops have the discretion to make those decisions at the street level, it benefits many people.
Right.
Right, when they just don't simply hook them up. We know that now. Now, of course, the big elephant in the room is how much discretion do we give them, right? Well, that needs to be ferreted out.
Right.
Senator Wissett?
Thank you, Chair. Chief Teague, you say that Neighborhood Watch is not an effective program. That seems counterintuitive to me. Could you explain your perception of why that isn't effective?
Actually, I can't tell you all the details of the study. What I can tell you is that the study, a good rigorous study, shows that Neighborhood Watch programs do not reduce crime in high crime areas. In your neighborhood and mine, they probably do. In high crime areas, simply establishing a Neighborhood Watch program does not reduce crime. There are other components that must be a part of that in those areas. So in my jurisdiction, in some of those high crime neighborhoods, we not only establish Neighborhood Watch where we can, we also try to pay more attention to them. In your neighborhood, for example, the police departments probably have or ask for annual meetings. Well, we know that in high crime neighborhoods, we need to have more than just annual meetings with Neighborhood Watch programs. We need to do more hand-holding, pay more attention to those neighborhoods. So Neighborhood Watch alone does not, the study show, reduce crime in high crime neighborhoods.
Another question? The other question I had, you were asking that, suggesting that DPSST could have a program for more advanced studies or whatever, and in evidence-based practices. And in most of the small police agencies that I represent, they don't really have budgets for that. So how would we, if we provided that service, how would you afford to use it?
In the immediate future, I don't have an answer for that question. We're talking about a multi-year, perhaps decades-long change in the way we do policing. If nothing else, as we educate new executives and supervisors as they come through DPSST, we'll begin to see these appropriate, if we call them appropriate, changes occurring. On the immediate horizon, I don't have the answer to that question. I'm sure if DPSST is tasked that direction, it's not difficult for them to come up with a program. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. Just quickly in response to that question and to add to it, it's a very good question. I think one of the challenges facing law enforcement leaders in Oregon right now is that one of the casualties of budget cuts over the last two bienniums is that the supervisory and leadership training program at DPSST no longer exists. The requirements to achieve executive certification are continue to be there, but there is no DPSST opportunity to create that. And so agencies like John's and others are left to themselves to try to cobble together some kind of leadership experience. And for us, that is, it creates a situation where our leaders are less equipped to lead because we don't have at DPSST those programs that are critically important to us. And I know that from a budget perspective in the state, training does not seem very sexy. There's nothing sexy about training. In local departments, often training is the first budget line item that gets cut. But from our standpoint, all the issues that cause you trouble at the legislature, whether it's race-based policing, eyewitness ID, use of force, all of those things, a lack of character in police departments and the increasing number of decertifications, all of that is addressed to some degree and to an important degree through training of leaders, that executive leadership and supervisory training. Good, well-trained leaders produce good results in their departments. And when that's taken away, you will have more issues coming to your table from parties that are not happy with the way policing is going. So I appreciate you letting me come back up to the table to address that. It is that there is no funding right now for any of those programs. They do not exist at DPSST any longer. Thank you.
Further?
Bill? So, Craig, members of the committee, Judge Brewer recommended to me a book by a Harvard Law School professor, The Collapse of the American Criminal Justice System, in which this man analyzes over 150 years of data in the United States. One of the premises he comes to, in areas that have traditionally, for that period of time, have had a low police-to-population ratio, in other words, there are more police officers, the lower the crime rate is. And his conclusion is, if you add that to scientific policing, you get a very good return for your dollar. So what we're talking about is training and numbers. Crime doesn't even happen.
Just one other comment. In years past, I know DPSST would send out, they actually had trainers that would go out. And so smaller communities, especially Senator Witsit's district, which are kind of far-flung, they could get the training. And are they not doing that anymore? They no longer have that budget piece? Or?
Well, I appreciate that Senator Cruz sent me a slow pitch right in the middle of the box, and Kevin Campbell came in and pinch hit for me, because that was a good question, and he provided the right answer. With regard to this question specifically, agencies do have the means to get their executives and supervisors to DPSST. And DPSST used to have the means to get training out to the field, absolutely. And as Kevin noticed, and it's vitally important, I touched on it in my testimony, that is now missing. It's a significant loss, especially as we define what law enforcement will look like in the future.
Thank you.
Mr. I would suggest what Kevin said about agencies having to cobble something together to do their own training, and so we've got this and this and this when we're trying to get a unified system. I think it's going at cross purposes.
I agree. Yeah. Anything further? Okay, thank you very much, Chief.
Yes, thank you, sir.
Mr. Bierman, you want to come up, please? State your name and we can go.
Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Jim Bierman, and as Kevin said earlier, I'm a retired cop from California. I spent 33 years with the Redlands Police Department. I was the chief there for 13 years, retired in June of 2011, and since then I've been an executive fellow with the U.S. Department of Justice and George Mason University. I have affiliations with Cambridge University also, and starting Monday, I'll be the president of the Police Foundation in Washington, D.C., which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit research organization whose entire mission is to advance policing through innovation and research. So, enough said about me. That's who I am. I hope that I have a chance to address some, if not all, of the questions that you just posed. These are very insightful questions. They get to the heart of evidence-based policing, and I tell you that many of your questions also speak to some of the fundamental issues that we're facing in policing. Your interaction with a police officer many years ago is very similar to mine. It's how I got in the business. I got captured by a police officer in my hometown riding a mini bike, and it was that interaction, because of the way he treated me and kept my mom from killing me, quite frankly, that caused me to think that maybe this is something that I could do, and it ultimately is how I ended up in the business, and I've never forgotten that. And it was all about a respectful interaction that this longtime cop had with this young kid who didn't know what the heck he was up to. I won't go through all of these points, but I'd be amazed if you weren't in agreement with me that all of our worlds are changing rather radically, whether it's fiscal perspectives, social, political, technology. Every day you wake up, read the paper, and something new has happened. I was watching CNN this morning, and there's been very sad events in Libya that affect the interests of this country, with the assassination of our ambassador there. And so every day, our world is different. And that is the reality for street cops. We are in the social milieu, and every day is a different experience. That's probably what draws most of us to this business. It is an exciting business, not all the time, but most of the time, and it is challenging in ways that I can hardly explain. In my own department, starting in 2007, between then and the time I left, we lost a third of the department. The entire department, civilians and sworn officers, the entire budget shrunk by a third by the time I left. So we were forced with making a couple of decisions. Do we throw in the towel and sing the budgetary sad song, or do we work very diligently to try to find a different way to deliver services? Some of you have asked questions that relate to that in terms of training and how you get to police departments that have small number of resources or are geographically isolated from the training centers or other things. And I will just tell you that police chiefs and sheriffs, and I've been around them for a long time in many parts of this country and in other countries, are very innovative people, and if you give them a mission, they'll figure out how to solve that. A failure is just not an option for cops in their day-to-day activity. When they're responding to some kind of an emergency, you don't get to give up. You don't get thrown in the towel. So when we think about how strategically how we think about policing, how we try to reframe what may be common sense in many minds. The three of your first four questions, by the way, related to what is in the science called police legitimacy and procedural justice. In its simplest terms, it's just the way we interact with each other. But there is science behind that, and there is evidence that suggests that we don't do it at the level that we think we should. So Peter Drucker, who is was from my neck of the woods, Claremont University, one of the world's greatest leadership theorists, said this about change and the essence of it, and I suggest that that's true in your world as policymakers and legislators. It is certainly true in business, and it is absolutely true in the world of policing. Another kind of smart guy said the following about how we think about those problems. And when I read this quote many, many years ago, it kind of changed the way I see the world. In my department, we, by the time I left, we had run five what are called randomized control trials on our policing strategies to make sure that they work. I have one of the advantages of policing in the town that raised you is that you are very focused on being a good steward of the taxpayer investment in public safety. So we constantly, as part of our organizational value, we're asking ourselves, how do we build a better mousetrap? What is it that we can do to do things better and be good stewards of what the people have given us? So when we think more globally about what is the role of state government in local policing, I think it's clear to me anyway, having been involved in the world of evidence-based policing now for about 15 years, that one of the many gifts that you as a body and individually can give the taxpayers of your districts or the communities is this notion of using evidence-based policing. So you'll see me refer to that as EBP, just for brevity's sake here, is a way of leveraging the existing taxpayer investment in public safety. So each city, the state government has invested a lot of money in public safety, whether they're in the fire services, policing, but putting cops on the street is not an inexpensive proposition. In California, we are watching the reframing of how we think about everything within the criminal justice system, from the number of police officers communities should have and can afford, to their pension systems, to the number of people we have incarcerated. Before the realignment movement began, California incarcerated more people than any other state in the union. I would encourage you to look at what California has done previously and don't repeat our experience, because it just didn't work well and it created all kinds of havoc. One of you mentioned the notion of incarceration. Inappropriate incarceration has a criminogenic effect. It actually can create problems. If you think of county jails and prison systems as educational models, when you send somebody to prison, you are sending them to graduate school. Well, I'm not saying that that's inappropriate. I'm just saying that you're going to teach them how to be better crooks when they get out, if that's how they're predisposed. We know from decades of research that a balanced and comprehensive approach to controlling crime has these three main components: prevention, intervention, and suppression. More recent scientific inquiry into this is very clear that certainty and the swiftness by which we hold people accountable is very important in terms of the deterrence of individuals, which is really what we all hope to be. I think our perfect world is that no young people mess up their lives through drug addiction or inappropriate behavior, problem behavior, that no adults commit crimes, that we're all contributing members of society. That is our perfect world. That doesn't exist. If it did, we wouldn't have prisons and jails. And police officers would be relegated to responding primarily to emergency situations as first responders, much like firefighters do. When we talk about the notion of deterrence, I think it is helpful sometimes to think in with different models in mind. And so one model that has been bandied about a little bit in the business is about this industrial industrialized model of policing and the criminal justice system. So if you think of it as an assembly line, where at the far end may be your state prison system, the most expensive way for you to control the behavior of people on the street is by incarcerating them. But at the front end, and this is really gets to the, I think, the essence of evidence-based policing, is this notion that if the police can be valuable in deterring inappropriate behavior, if they can help young people see that they shouldn't commit crimes and somewhere downstream end up in juvenile facilities, county jails, and prisons, then they have, not only have they perhaps saved lives, they've saved the destruction of many lives and the pain and suffering that grandmothers and grandfathers, parents, brothers, sisters go through when their children become drug-addicted adults or incarcerated, but they also save taxpayers huge amounts of money by avoiding those downstream costs. You will see lots of analogies, and you'll probably come about this on your own in my presentation relative to medicine, because the notion of evidence-based policing is really has its roots in the world of evidence-based medicine. And I'll come back to that in just a second. But if you think about preventative medicine as opposed to waiting until a medical condition that you have ignored has gone by, you'll save yourself a lot of pain and suffering and costs downstream. So here's just a couple of real critical points, and I won't dwell on these long, but police officers do count. You have to have a number of police officers in our society today to engage in the deterrence of crime, but also just to be available to handle 911 calls. How many police officers you need is a very complicated question, and mostly it relates to community expectations. Many years ago, the FBI would publish a recommended ratio of police officers to population. When they realized that that was really a very poor way of trying to help policymakers answer the question of how many cops do we need, they stopped doing this. And the reason that doesn't work is because of the differences from community to community. And all you have to do is think about where you live and places you've visited. Portland is different from Salem, which is different from Bend. Every city has its own unique demographics and sociological issues that ultimately end up resulting in crime and disorder and the need for police officers. There's also political expectations about what do you expect the police to do. If all you expect the police to do is respond when you call 911, you need fewer cops. But there is a baseline tipping point, low number, below which, if you don't have them, then when you call 911, they're not going to show up. But as you get into these other things, it just depends on what you're trying to achieve. And this is where evidence-based policing is very helpful, because it sets aside many of the emotions that are caught up in crime and disorder issues and tries to focus just on what does the science tell us. So it started as early as 1900s. When you look at the roots of what we now call evidence-based policing, this chief, August Vollmer, many years ago, decided that he should try to use scientific methods, mostly in the area of forensics, to try to help solve crimes. And so I mentioned earlier about this notion of evidence-based medicine. How many of you would go to a physician that you knew did not follow scientific evidence about how to fix your broken leg or treat your malaria or your cancer or whatever medical problem you might have. Personally, I would probably try and find another physician. So we take it as just given that our physicians go to medical school, they learn about the science of medicine and health, and those practices that they engage in are evidence-based. This is not true, as Chief Tigg said, in the world of policing. Policing has evolved in a different way and is increasingly beginning to use scientific evidence about controlling crime and disorder, but most of what drives us in, not only in this country, but quite frankly, across the globe, although this is changing in places like the United Kingdom, our organizational culture, culture, community expectations, and our experiences, what we've always done before. So why is it important? I will say repeatedly, you'll hear me talk about this a lot, is that, first of all, it's effective at controlling crime. It helps us get better through the process of evaluating what works to control crime and disorder. We can set aside those things that don't work and focus on those things that do. And it depends on the measuring stick we're using. I think you asked a question about Neighborhood Watch. And the evidence is fairly clear that Neighborhood Watch will not prevent or reduce crime. But it does do other things that are useful depending on community expectations. It'll raise the confidence level in the police. It can increase police legitimacy. In the United Kingdom, for instance, the singular issue besides the budget that is driving policing practices there is this notion of confidence in the police. And we might hear that as police legitimacy, but it is this very significant public sentiment that the police are not doing what we want them to do. They're not being polite to us. They're being officious, and as a result, we don't like what's going on, and we're not going to cooperate with them. And so I'll talk a little more about police legitimacy in just a second. So why doesn't everybody do it? This is such a great idea. The way we think in terms of evidence-based practices in the world of policing is evolving rather rapidly. I thought your question about academics, Senator, was and the interplay between the police and universities, it was really, really interesting. I'll comment on that in just a second here. But we have generally focused on the more the skill set part of policing more than we have the conceptual how do we control crime piece. When times were good, we were able to do that in California when local budgets were flush. We could throw cops at problems because we had the ability to do that. So if we had a crime problem, we would solve it in the most basic way, which, by the way, is the most expensive way to do this. We just hired more cops and we put more police officers on the problem. That generates all kinds of dynamics, some of which are helpful and some of which are not helpful, because we usually did that, and we certainly did it in California, without a sense that not everybody needs to go to jail. And so we used incarceration as the principal way of controlling crime. And again, I would point to our correctional system that at its peak had 300,000 people in it. 175,000 were actually incarcerated, and the system is rapidly falling apart. And we are now going through this complete realignment of how we think about it, because we were not thoughtful, quite frankly. We didn't follow the evidence that tells us what we do. One of the major reasons that academics and police officers are a bit apart has to do with the way in academia, there's a couple things, it has to do with the police culture and our openness to new ideas brought to us by people that we don't perceive to be experts in policing. But we also have to look at the way academics gain tenure. And so I have many friends who are professors in a variety of world-class institutions, and I've had many discussions with them about this, and I can tell you with, I think, some certainty that I'm not aware of one university whose tenure process allows academics who seek tenure to write anything other than peer-reviewed articles. So there's this notion of peer or public or publisher or parish in academia, and publish means in academic journals that are peer-reviewed. Police chiefs and sheriffs, first of all, they don't generally know what those are, and they don't have the time to read a 300-page academic report or article that relates to hotspot policing, for instance. They're very bottom-line people. None of their training, unless they've done it on their own, speaks to this. I have gone through many, many training, police-related training programs in my career. Not one minute of my police training in California that has a pretty extensive program has dealt with some of these very pressing issues that relate to how I understand and consume good science. How do I know good science from bad science? How do I use it as a police chief? How do I use it as a street cop? Not one minute has been there. Not one minute has also been about addiction and what the role we can play in that, police legitimacy, or prisoner reentry, which is a huge issue for us in California. So this is in large part about rethinking that. Lastly, one of the reasons that this has not been widely adopted is that the reward systems that police officers use, especially police chiefs. I have sat on many police chief interview panels for other cities. I have friends who are executive recruiters across the United States and in California, and I don't know of one police chief recruitment process where the questioning of the candidates was framed even in part around, so chief or wannabe chief in my department, tell me how you're going to use science to lower our costs, to be more effective, and to drive forward your police force. I've never heard that happen. So until those reward systems begin to change, there's a pragmatic reality about how police chiefs and police chief candidates think about this issue. So when we think about good science, I won't go into this, this gets a bit complicated. The gold standard for science, whether it be in medicine, biotech, engineering, whatever, is this thing called the randomized controlled trial, where you have a control group, you have a treatment group, and you randomize it. Now, the state of Oregon is at the forefront, I think, in the United States in terms of a portion of your criminal justice system, the correctional side, I'll probably get this number wrong, SB 267, but compels the correctional system in Oregon to use evidence-based practices at a very high degree, 75%, I think, of the budget. I was, things kind of work, I was at dinner last night, and I was looking at my phone and emails that I get, and I'm on a mailing list for email list for a place called the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy in Washington, D.C. It's a nonprofit that helps Congress understand how better to drive programs based on evidence. And there was an Oregon program called the Parent Management Training Program that is now considered near, what's called near top-tier science or program that is near top tier. So top tier means it is the gold standard in evaluating the effectiveness of a program. It is very hard to get to that point. It is very difficult. But again, last night, PMTO is there, and that is a program that helps newly separated mothers with young boys help keep those kids out of trouble. And the findings of that are substantial, on the order of a 50% reduction in downstream arrest rates for the kids and for the mothers. That is the kind of work that is important, not only in saving lives, but also saving dollars. So these issues that I put up here are just primarily to give you a sense of the kinds of things that, quite frankly, we should be teaching police officers, city managers, the people that make policies at the local level, how best to understand science. Because, not, as I said, not all good science, not all science is good, and there's ways to evaluate that. In the world of policing, I won't go through each of these, but you'll see some of these titles used, and some of them have very clear connections to the world of evidence-based practices and science. Smart policing is one. It's a U.S. Department of Justice funded initiative. Predictive policing is in the news a lot these days. I'm not sure about the science behind that yet. Intelligence-led policing has a lot of science behind it. And this notion of crime in place is critically important to us understanding how we best control crime in an efficient and effective manner. So how do we connect the dots? How do we make, I think you had a question about what street cops think about this, and police officers out in the field are very pragmatic in their orientation. So how do you make this scientific kind of esoteric idea real for them, and there's a variety of ways to do it. The most important, I think, in all of this is this notion of translational criminology. So the college president you spoke about that is a criminologist could probably speak to this quite eloquently, that it is difficult sometimes to talk in scientific terms and then get practitioners to understand, okay, I get the idea, I understand that, but what does that mean every day for my patrol shift that has to hit the street and do something? What does it mean when my police department just was reduced by a third? And these are really practical problems. So this is part of why I took this job that I made reference to. And my work in the future is going to be all about this translational piece. This is what I did for the last year for the Department of Justice in D.C., was to help them think through how you speak to practitioners and make sure that you are grounded in your science, but also that they understand the practical implications of things like focusing on crime in place or what are called the life course studies of offenders. And are there places in that life course that we can intervene to deter them? So one of the projects I worked on and I thought, and I'm very proud of, that I think is helpful is try to, and this idea came from John Lobb, who's a presidential appointee to the National Institute of Justice. He runs the place, and he's still a tenured professor at the University of Maryland. He is a criminologist and was the 2011 Stockholm Prize winner, which is criminology's equivalent of the Nobel Prize. And he asked me to work on what are the five things that police chiefs and policymakers ought to know. In simple, direct, plain language, what are the things that we ought to know about controlling crime? So here are these things. I'll run through them very quickly, more in depth, to try to flesh them out. But when we talk about, and this is still predominant in policing, by the way, this notion of randomly patrolling in the hope that we will find crime, it doesn't work. I can count on one hand the number of serious crimes as I was a patrol officer driving along where I saw some guy committing a serious crime. I've never seen some guy climbing into the side of a window on somebody's house committing a residential burglary. Most serious crime is not detected by the police. It is the result of a neighbor seeing that guy climbing in the window and picking up the phone, calling 911 and saying there's a guy burglarizing my neighbor's house. Or it's an alarm system that reports an in-progress robbery of a convenience store or things like that. It's not to say the police don't do a lot of work, but serious crime mostly is reported to the police in another way, and then we respond to it. So focusing where crime is occurring through the use of our data systems, crime mapping, crime analysis, and looking at what are called hotspots is much more productive. And there are lots and lots of studies. The early studies came out of the Police Foundation that are seminal, and they've been repeated multiple times. This last point here, the Koper curve, named after Chris Koper, who's a professor at George Mason, tells us that we don't even have to spend a lot of time in those places. 15 minutes or so of directed patrol by a police officer engaged in high profile activities is enough to lower the crime rate for a period of time. When you couple that with problem solving, that is profoundly important. When we think about response times, and this is perhaps a bigger issue in some ways in the urban environment because of the politics involved in all of this, we think a lot about how fast the cops get there, and I will tell you that the evidence does not support a quick response perspective, with the exception of in-progress crimes. So the speed at which the police get to a call does not correlate with the prevention of crime. Now, there are exceptions. If there is an in-progress crime and the caller stays on the phone, for instance, and can call in the airstrike of that deputy or that police officer, then it makes a difference. But with the lag time, if I come home and I find my house has been burglarized, and I call you, and it takes you an hour to get there to do the investigation, or 2 hours, will make no difference as a general rule in whether that crime is ultimately solved, and it'll have no difference and no impact on whether or not we prevented any crime. So there are call management strategies that the evidence has shown are more effective. You can do things so you increase your service levels. But there is a public expectation about this, and this is where sometimes being a police chief or a sheriff is more of an art than it is a science, because everything is different. We know that collecting DNA evidence can increase the solution of property crimes and violent crimes. I will tell you, across the United States, across the globe, This is a conundrum for everybody because nobody has enough money to hire enough criminalists to do the work and to do all this. But the evidence is very true, but everybody has this problem. In my county, it was so problematic that the only DNA evidence we could get the crime lab to do because of funding restrictions was on murder cases. And those were murder cases with named suspects. This is the issue that three of your four first questions related directly to. This is what's called police legitimacy. It is the way in which police officers conduct themselves in terms of a traffic stop, for instance. If I stop you, and we're talking about non-high-risk traffic stops, but these quote-unquote routine traffic stops, do I walk up and say, hello, I'm Officer or Deputy Bierman, I've stopped you because you were speeding. Is there a reason that you might have been speeding? That something as simple as that, and that's generally taught in the basic academy, it has been tested repeatedly. It is currently under examination in a lot of places. But that model, compared to the model I was taught, this is how I was taught to do a traffic stop. I walk up, good afternoon, can I see your license and registration? I haven't given you an opportunity to explain to me why you were going in excess of the speed limit. Maybe you had a medical emergency. Maybe you had just had a death in the family and your head is just not in the car. It didn't matter. I'm the police, you're not. I'd like your license and registration, and I go back to my car, I write a ticket because I was taught not to give you the opportunity to argue with me, and then I come back, and that's when I first explain to you why you're getting the ticket. If you think that through a little bit, think about how you would respond to that, I don't think you'd like that. Everybody likes to give an opportunity, to have an opportunity to give their side of the story. Now, that's a very simplistic view of this. It's a little bit more complicated, but the notion of police legitimacy is, in my humble opinion, the most important issue for American policing today. It is absolutely what is at the forefront of all of the tensions between the police and communities of color, diverse communities. It's between cops and kids. It's between a variety of things. And this is, they label it differently in the UK, but they'll call it this public confidence. But it's about my sense of legitimacy. And all you have to do is think about people that have received tickets or been treated in ways that you thought were not right by the police, to understand that on a more fundamental level. And lastly, is this notion that science can help us better understand the things that we should be doing to increase officer safety and well-being. There is a working group that the Police Foundation is part of that includes the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Police Executive Research Forum, all of the major police advocacy or constituency groups, as well as the parts of the U.S. Department of Justice that focus on this. Because last year we saw the highest number of police officers killed in the United States. For the first time in a very long time, more cops were shot and killed than they were killed in traffic accidents. But just as the military is having an ongoing, very soul-wrenching introspective inquiry into the suicide rate of members of our military. That is a well-being issue. When we talk about well-being, so too should we have this discussion within policing. There are policing shift work is difficult. There's the Police Foundation just released a study that looks at police officer fatigue and shift study in a randomized controlled trial. So it's a top-tier piece of research that talks about the things that we should do to keep those people safe, to keep us safe. So, trying to get back to this fundamental idea of what role, in my humble opinion, can the state of Oregon play to help Oregon police officers do a better job, a safer job, and do it at a lower cost. This notion that Garvin at Harvard talks about, and is not new to him, he just has this notion about a learning organization. It's really what, I think one of your questions related to, how do you get training out to police agencies that have trouble because of their resources getting to the academy. Your academy, by the way, I visited yesterday, and I have been in a lot of police academies, and in that police academy is top-notch, five-star, better than anything I have personally seen at the federal level or at the state level, and much better than any academy you will ever find in the state of California. So you should be very proud of that facility and what they do there. But helping people understand and learn what it is that they should be doing is really about downstream savings and leveraging the taxpayer investment and things. So this ancient proverb about you can catch a fish and give it to a man today and you feed him, or you can teach him how to fish and he feeds his entire life, is really fundamental to this notion of what goes on at your academies, and what should be the fundamental underpinning, I think, of this notion of leadership development. You heard from Kevin that because of financial constraints, you've not been able to fund at the level that you probably would like, and I can absolutely tell you is necessary for the professional and how you would be happy with the evolution of police departments. You have got to spend some time and effort on leadership development, because it is there that we find the ability to change our organizations, to help us do the right thing. It is all about leadership. So I won't give you guys a lecture on leadership. You know about more about this than I do. But I have many friends who are pilots. I started an air support unit in my police department years before I left. And I'm not a pilot. But one thing my friends that are pilots have told me is flying a plane is very easy. And a trained monkey can do it. I kept hearing this. As long as, and here's the important caveat, everything is going well. And as Captain Sullenberger demonstrated to the entire world, that when things don't go well, you better hope that the guy that is at the controls of that plane has adequate training. This is not dissimilar to what happens in policing. When everything is going well in a community, policing isn't that difficult. When everybody behaves and they cooperate with you and there's no violence and you don't have money problems, you know, it works. Tell me when that actually happened. I told you my experience. I lost a third of my department before I left. Things were not going well. We were having crime problems. We were having all kinds of problems. So we looked to increasingly more and more evidence-based practices, but more importantly, spending a lot of time talking about leadership development. So I'm going to give you a blast of just, this is just my opinion, take it for what it's worth, about something that you guys could do. Oregon has an opportunity. Whether you want to do this or not is an entirely different question, but Oregon has an opportunity to be a state wide example, a nationwide example about how you realign the criminal justice system relative to policing and the rest of it downstream around evidence-based practices that doesn't really cost you much, if any, money. Because to do evidence-based policing, one of the myths is that it costs you more money. It doesn't cost you a dime more to do it. Someday, we will not even be talking about evidence-based policing, by the way, just like we don't talk about evidence-based medicine. It will be the way policing is done. We will look to what science tells us works to control crime and disorder. That's the way we'll be taught, and we'll just do it. We'll drop off this notion of evidence-based policing. Because all the police officers in the state come through your state academy, you have a centralized model that I think works beautifully for trying to get everybody on the same page of music. Because one of the things that's important to remember about crime is it doesn't care about geopolitical boundaries. You care about your boundaries because that's where your constituents are, but criminals don't care about your boundaries, they don't care about city limits, they don't care about county lines, they don't care. Crime and disorder goes where there's opportunity and where the social conditions allow that to work. Using the academy as a way to start first with the conceptual infrastructure through leadership development and helping people understand why this is important, and this is, relates to lifelong learning, is fundamental to the next piece that I would suggest to you, that you could easily, with very little money, seed the state of Oregon with a couple of these centers where you put a criminologist, a research assistant, a crime analyst, and a clerk, probably costing you less than three police officers would cost you, that would then leverage every investment every community in the state has made in every community by serving out, after a translation piece, serving out scientific findings about what works to control crime and disorder. This is a very, very, very important thing. There are experts in our world that we refer to all the time. If I'm ill, I go to a physician. If I want to buy a house, I go to a realtor. If I have a legal problem, I go to a lawyer. If I want to know what the science tells me about crime and disorder control, I need to go to a criminologist. But translating what the criminologist knows to what the street cop needs to use in practical terms is a very thoughtful, systematic process called evidence-based policing. So if you guys had the desire to create a national model, and I extend the offer of help from the Police Foundation in that, at least I can officially do that on Monday, you will create a model that can be replicated across the United States, but not only across the United States, you can also extend that into a global perspective. Emerging democracies are dying for evidence-based practices and information about how to police in a safe and secure manner without violating everybody's rights. In many countries, you know this, the police are not the good guys. They are an arm of totalitarian regimes. So helping them understand that you don't have to do it that way, that you can do it in a legitimate way, makes a lot of sense. But with just two things, leadership development that has, as a portion, framed around evidence-based policing, and the infusing a creation of just a couple of these centers that you could put in a sheriff's department or a police department, so all you're talking about are a few people. You could change over the next 5 years or so, you could literally change the complexion of how police departments in this country, or in this state, work. And I'll leave you with this last thought, because I think this is really what you do. Most of the work of policymakers is not about today. It's really about tomorrow. And so this kind of smart guy said this, that the true meaning of life is to plant trees under whose shade we do not expect to sit. The work you do today for the people of the state of Oregon is not something that you might ever see the fruits of. You are doing things for future generations. So the decisions you may make in the future that I encourage you to make about evidence-based practices for policing and how you help the leaders of law enforcement in the state of Oregon develop will really serve the cops that are coming down the road and the people that live in the communities, not so much today or tomorrow, but over the future. So it's been a pleasure chatting with you, and I'll entertain any questions you may have.
Committee members, questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. It's really interesting. I have a question about one of the issues that you actually didn't spend a lot of time talking about, although you mentioned on SB 267, which we're going to hear a little bit more about, the prevention treatment programs, evidence-based treatment programs. Can you talk a little bit about international and national research that's been done on drug decriminalization, since we spend a big percentage, as you mentioned, of our...
Well, you know, and it's controversial. I mean, you know, this has so much to do with, bless you, with the societal expectations of people. You know, how we think about drugs in this country, or one state thinks about them differently, is very different than, let's say, Holland thinks about them. So there are specific studies that are emerging from places like Holland, for instance, because Amsterdam has become kind of this touchstone, I think, for a lot of people on both sides of this particular issue. Does it work? Does it not work? Does it create bigger problems? Does it not create bigger problems? But I'm not clear, as that is not my area of expertise, is substance abuse, except as it relates to policing activities. I spent a lot of time with drug courts and the interplay between how police officers can be helpful or not helpful to treatment providers and the people in treatment. It is not difficult as a police officer to drive somebody in treatment out of treatment because of your behavior and the legitimacy or lack thereof and the manner in which you treat them. But the bigger question, as I believe as I understand you're asking me, is about the science of whether or not decriminalizing what we now think of as illegal drugs is a smart thing to do or not. Is that mm-hmm. essentially it?
Yeah, just to follow up, Mr. Chair, the question, the research that I've seen predominantly that's applied to Europe has shown that, I was reading a report about the amount of money that, in particular, Spain and Portugal was spending on their low-level drug crimes, and that they decided to take that money and invest in prevention, but also they decriminalized at the same time, did clean needles, all that, and they were able to then reinvest that money into higher level crimes, and they found overall it was a much more effective way. And I think that's the type of information at the national, international level that would help, because otherwise we're just on this...
Well, certainly.
You know, at the state level, we don't have the resources to do that type of international research.
And the research relative to treatment, which is a slightly different issue than the decriminalization of illegal drugs, but the research about treatment, I think, is very clear. One of the best examples right now that we've seen in the evaluations that are being done, and it's very timely, is called Project Hope in Hawaii. And Project Hope is very effective for dealing with drug-addicted criminal offenders. And I can tell you, I spent many years as a narcotics officer, and I can tell you that we are never going to win this particular quote-unquote war on drugs, thinking the way we continue to think. It's just, we don't have the resources to do this. In California, 85% of the people that we've got in prison are drug addicted. So if you could deal with the addiction component somehow and do this in a comprehensive way, and I think the police have a role to play in that. We certainly did with our drug court and how we orient that. And our success rate 3 years after graduation from the program in our program was 85%. So I'll take an 85% success rate compared to an 85% failure rate, which is what happens in the prison system any day of the week. So the science around treatment is and addiction is better, I think, than the science around decriminalization issues, right? Those are more policy issues and what you want to do relative to that. But what does make a lot of sense for me is for us to look at the science about what works to effectively help people deal with their addictions, whether it's alcohol or drug use, because it has so many downstream implications from a societal perspective or a cost perspective.
Senator Courtney?
Thank you, Chair Krieger. You fascinate me, Chief Bowman. Can I ask you some personal questions about your academic background?
Ask me whatever you like.
You have a bachelor's degree?
Yes, sir.
What's it
in? It's a dual major in criminal justice and Spanish.
Where'd you get that?
California State University.
You have a master's degree?
I do.
What's that in?
In management from the University of Redmond.
You have a PhD?
I do not.
This issue of higher ed that you've heard me stumble into, can I just ask him some of these questions? I'm fascinated by it because it startles me. It caught me totally off guard. Is it your position on tenure that the fallacy, the problem with tenure is that, and a little bit about tenure, that when an individual, a professor decides I want to be tenured, that their paper, whatever, their publications, reviewed only by professors. They're not reviewed by chiefs of police or superintendents of state. Is that what it is? Or that the paper must contain, the publications must contain the nitty-gritty work with people who literally are on the front lines, are on patrol, etc. I mean, I couldn't quite understand
sure.
that.
So I want to be clear about that because it's obvious I wasn't. I'm not commenting on the peer or the tenure process. That's not my area of expertise. My expertise with universities is I've gone to them and as a student, and I worked for them as a fellow, or sit on an advisory board for them. But what I was commenting on was the reason that there is a gap between researchers, one of the reasons, between researchers and practitioners like police chiefs.
The researchers are professors of criminal higher ed. That's what you mean by research.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
The academics, why there is a gap between them, and I have heard this multiple times from my friends who are on tenure tracks, who are professors at universities, is that they understand that practitioners would read a publication like Police Chief Magazine, for instance. That is the publication put out by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. IACP is the world's largest constituent organization for police chiefs. They can write a practitioner-oriented article for the Police Chief Magazine, and they'll get absolutely no credit as it relates to their pursuit of tenure. They only get credit in this publisher-parish world if they are writing peer-reviewed articles right. in professional journals. So I'm not commenting on whether they should or shouldn't do that. I'm saying that this doesn't help us in the practitioner understand the findings of those researchers.
Okay, one last question. I am taken about that Oregon be the national model, et cetera, et cetera. Are you blowing smoke? Is this the thing like tomorrow you'll be before the Illinois legislature or the Alabama legislature or the Michigan? You'll say, you know, Michigan, you know, you could be the model. Is there something? Because you were very nice about our DPSC training facility. You said it was the best you'd ever seen. Because I remember being involved in that thing in the hay.
Yeah.
Assuming you meant what you said.
Absolutely.
And by the way, I feel very bad about California. I mean it. I love the West. I'm really feeling bad about your state and what's going on. But so So why is Oregon, uniquely positioned? You just said that to be saying that because that's what you do now that you've got this national title and you're very good at it. And just tell it like it is, because because I'm so old, I like to hear things like that, but I never believe them.
Sure.
So just tell me, is it real or not?
You'll have to judge that for yourself later on, but I have no vested interest to sit here and blow smoke at you. I don't have to be here. Nobody.
Why did you say that about Oregon?
Because I think it's true.
Because?
Because you have a centralized model. You have in this county a sheriff that understands this in ways that I probably, he's the only sheriff I've heard speak about evidence-based practices.
About this Marin County sheriff?
Mm-hmm.
Not the other 35 sheriffs?
I haven't met them. I've only met this one.
There are 36 counties in my state.
I've only met this one. I've spoken with your executive director of your criminal justice planning agency. The executive director of the Chiefs Association. I have friends who are police chiefs up here that came from California, so we've compared things. Maybe only relevant to the veracity of my statement, but my grandmother's entire family is from Oregon. I didn't go into that. So my roots are up here in Oregon.
Okay.
But aside from all that, the funding for my organization, we have an endowment. Our funders are the federal government through research grants or high net worth, either individuals or corporations that are corporate donors. There's no upside for me to sit here and blow smoke with you. In fact, it's the worst thing I could possibly do because my trade in stock is my handshake with you. My word is worth everything to me. And that's how I see the world as a police officer. It's the way I always did things as a police chief, as a street cop. If you can't trust me, I have failed somewhere downstream. So it has nothing really to do with the organization. This is Jim Bierman telling you that I think because of your centralized model, because of this isn't, your problems here, well, they're not insignificant, are not like those faced in Camden, New Jersey, or someplace that is so out of control right now that you can't even take a breath, right, to do this kind of work. But I'm just giving you my opinion. Whether you all choose to do that or not,
thank you very much.
Sure.
I haven't put you on the spot. Thank you, Chair.
Appreciate
Chair, for indulging me in this conversation.
Governor Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm interested a little bit in kind of the nuts and bolts of a regional model that you're talking about. Is that limited to like a data dump center with a criminologist where outlying police departments would send information, it would be analyzed, and they'd get return and share information across boundaries? Or is it something deeper than that?
Well, what you've just described is what many people might label a fusion center or an information center. And this is not so much what I'm talking about. And again, this is just my opinion about and what I would do if I had a magic wand and you guys said to me, how do we infuse or anchor evidence-based practices and knowledge to the culture of our criminal justice system and specifically policing? So a center like this is not so much about information as it is about knowledge. It is about how do a very small group of people, because it really, you need a computer, you need a desk, and access to the internet, and that's how you access all of this research. A criminologist professional training will tell them how to translate that. If they have a board of advisors that's made up of police chiefs and sheriffs from that region, making sure that what they look at are things that are necessary for those police departments and those sheriff's departments to focus on. Do they square with local reality? Do they make common sense? You need a very small number of people, a criminologist, to do that work, to understand. I didn't go into what are called systematic reviews, but a systematic review done by somebody allows you to grab all of the known information and knowledge about a topic that's been rigorous science, has been involved in that, and then you find what are the lessons in that. And there's a lot of translating and distilling of that where you come up with like those five things. Here's what I need to know as a police chief. So you have a criminologist, you have a research assistant that helps them do that, and this is just practical. You could probably do this just with a criminologist and a clerk who then would disseminate all that. I think if you throw an analyst, a crime analyst in there, that's the person that would do what you're talking about, where they would have access to the data, the computer-aided dispatch and records management system data, the call for service data, those things, because inside of that data is knowledge. You have to go through and you do what's called data mining. You can map it. You can do all these things to get a better picture of what those calls for service show up. But what I'm suggesting is that you're really creating a knowledge center more than you are creating an information center, although the second one is very useful. And you might be able to merge both of those together, and you could probably do that through the work of the crime analyst, which is more about information management and understanding as opposed to broader knowledge about what's out in the universe. I don't know if that explains it.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Crusher. So in order to get that, something like that done, what you're describing, you would need buy-in from sheriffs, police chiefs, frontline police officers, obviously the politicians to make sure that the funding is there. What else would you need? Well, what would this group look like to make something like
that's
this
about
happen?
So what I would do is you'd have to look at a geographic area that makes sense, like the Willamette Valley, perhaps. Okay, I'm just using that because my sense of your geography is not what it probably should be. So if you took that as a geographic area where it made sense because people interact a lot there. There are personal relationships between the chiefs and the sheriff, so you have a collaborative, collegial environment. You put together a working group and say, this is what we want to do. We've got some money to do this. Who's willing to host this? In other words, who's going to give office space? And it could be a variety of places. It could be at the academy. You know, it doesn't, where they are is not that important. You create then this advisory group, and it's just a matter of implementing that piece. There is a developmental piece, though, that probably should precede that, which is getting everybody on the same page of music about the value of science and research in controlling crime and disorder, how we determine what's good and what is not good science, and what are the practical applications of doing that. That is like a day-long conversation with those practitioners. These are very smart people who just have never, in some cases, have never been exposed to it. You heard Chief Digg talk about it, and if the Sheriff Myers were here, you'd hear him talk about it. They have educated themselves on their own. They've gone off and discovered these things and noodled through them and done all that. And that's great, except it doesn't take it to scale very quickly, right? If you do this as part of a pilot project in whatever region you say, we're going to take this valley, we're going to constitute it here, we're going to stand it up, and here's the benchmark. Within 3 weeks, we're going to have a meeting of the chiefs and the number twos and the sheriffs and the undersheriffs to talk about this so we get on the same page of music. We're going to have it located in one place, and one of those people kind of takes the reins of coordinating the administrative kinds of things and answering to you guys, you know, about this if it's state-funded. You have the class, and then you just start assimilating the work. The knowledge exists out there, so you don't have to worry about creating original research. I would highly recommend that if you have a criminologist that they start looking at and validating that with some of their own research here, which is not difficult to do. But you don't even have to do that. You can just simply direct their acquiring the literature and the knowledge and translating it that already exists in the world today. As we speak today, there is more than enough science to reframe many pieces of what we know, for instance, about patrol work, about where you should put this hot spots study, and the notion of places, which have very significant land use implications for policymakers too, by the way, which is a whole other discussion. So you could do this probably. The thing that would take the longest is actually hiring people, but this is where you then reach out to your academic partners, and I didn't say that, but you should have a research, university research partner on that board of advisors just to help, you know, make sure everything's centered. But you could probably do this in 4 or 5 months. Again, the longest part is the hiring of the people. The rest of it is just a matter of getting everybody's schedules together and having an agreement that we're going to do this, and then agreeing on the evaluation criteria.
Yeah, I make this comment, then I'll question in the context of a father who's going to drop off his 18-year-old daughter at college on the 20th in Eugene. She's a genius, like her mom. But when I was a young man, I was, 1983 and 1985, I spent the month of August in Europe. And I remember stepping off the train for the first time in Amsterdam. There was a nice man selling hashish right there. And I also was a patron of the Bulldog Cafe, and they had a menu the size of that screen there with all kinds of things to smoke. that you wouldn't be able to purchase legally here in the state. They also had storefronts with picture windows that were bordered with Christmas lights with hookers advertising their wares. So I'm not convinced that the European model always is what's going to work around these parts. My question, though, is you just referenced the hotspots again. Are those hotspots in your research, and I think I already know the answer here, are there high unemployment rates in those spots usually? Because I think idle hands are the devil's helper. Well, I think the best thing we can do in this community is put people to work. But is there any correlation there?
Not necessarily.
Interesting.
Let me back up just a little bit and just to clarify something about your European comment. I don't disagree with what you're saying. That's what I was trying the point I was trying to get across is that there are big societal differences in the way we see the world and Europeans see the world and what may or may not work there. What I was saying, though, and I will maintain, is that we should spend a great deal of time focusing on treatment issues. We absolutely should do that. Whether young people mess up their lives through alcohol or drugs is almost irrelevant in some extent. Whether those become legal or illegal for policymakers like yourself to make a decision on in society in a broader sense. So hotspots, that when you look at a map, this is where this comes from, of a hotspot, right? It really kind of comes from the fire service and hotspots in the forest, which you guys have been dealing with a lot. Those hotspots, depending on what they represent, what the data behind that represents, can be auto burglaries, in which case they may focus on a mall where cars are, or apartment complexes and things. One thing we know, and I did this before I left, is we took social indicators. We took the data sets that we got from things like community surveys and unemployment rates and school failure rates, dropout rates, voting rates. Put those as data sets, overlaid those using geographic information system software, and looked at whether there was a correlation between general serious crime hotspots and the behavior. We were looking primarily at adolescents. And there was a correlation between certain risk factors like low attachment to school, the rate at which families moved at an accelerated rate around the community, so there was no attachment between the neighborhood institutions and the kids. Those kinds of things. There was a direct correlation between the hotspots of serious adolescent crime and those risk factors. So it just depends on how you look at it. You know, you'd have to look, if you wanted to answer that question, the way you would do that is look at where people live that are unemployed and then overlay the hotspots of crime and see if there's a correlation. That does not prove, by the way, that the unemployed people are committing the crimes. It is suggestive that there may be, and I want to underscore that repeatedly, there may be a relationship there. And then you just have to look at it more deeply, right? You have to drill down through that. But crime in communities generally tracks along other kind of social indicators. Crime is the outcome of several different components in a social equation of academic failure, substance abuse, unemployment, parental involvement with problem behaviors. I mean, you can add these up. This plus this plus this equals crime. And when you look at this, we had a year that we started this, 1998, we had a series of murders involving teenagers that were either the suspects or the offenders. And we went back over a 10-year period and looked at those things. And every single one of those murders involved very high sets of risk factors for either both the victim or the offender, certainly the offender. So, and there's a lot of work. At the University of Washington, Seattle, Hawkins and Catalano have done some seminal work on what are called risk and protective factors that relate to this. And one of those would be the family connection to these other social things that you're talking about, like unemployment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From my perspective, chronic unemployment, illegal drug activity, and gang activity, criminal gang activity, are probably the three major factors in Oregon crime. And I haven't heard you mention gang activity in all of your discourse. I wonder if you could direct us to a source of evidence-based practices for addressing criminal gang activity.
Sure. There are several sources. The U.S. Department of Justice has a website called crimesolutions.gov. The Center for Evidence-Based Crime Policy at George Mason University has a tool called the Matrix, which is a visual representation representation of 120 of the most rigorous evaluations of crime control strategies. So you can look to both of those for evidence-based strategies that focus on gangs and drugs and a variety of different things, and those get stratified. So drug activity, for instance, there are open-air drug markets, there's personal use issues and treatment issues, so you have to kind of slice that particular broad topic down. And then the gang about the gang science is robust, and it has to do a great deal with these things that we were just talking about here with the risk and protective factors. When you look at what are the precursors to gang membership, there's frequently going to be family affiliation with that. I learned this behavior from my brother, my older brother, from my parents. I've done lots of work with former offenders. My wife was a school gardening person for many, many, many years, and had as community service opportunities parolees and probationers that came and worked, so I would work with her and work with them. And, you know, when you dig holes with somebody for a couple hours on, and you start talking about all kinds of things. And so not only my personal experience as a narcotics officer and working gangs as a street cop, but also more recently talking to them about how they ended up where they were, you'll hear this repeatedly. So this is anecdotal, it's not scientific, but the anecdotes track along with the scientific evidence about what causes you to become a gang member. And it's almost always something that we can see and we can predict, and the precursors to gang membership are things we know about. The question is, do we have the resources to be able to intervene and do something about those things? So much like the Oregon study that I just, the Oregon program that I just referenced, that program is about helping recently single mothers deal with their sons and try to keep those sons out of trouble, right? So that's a parent training strategy that has been evaluated through a randomized control model, so it's top tier, that shows, and now it wasn't gang affiliated per se, but it was talking about the reduction in arrests by 50%. It reduced arrests of the cohort of those kinds of kids. So I think when you look at the gang research, you're going to find that a lot of it has to do with parental training. We did in my department, we taught a program called the Parent Project, which was a parent training program primarily for, we taught it in English and Spanish, but what ultimately happened were newly immigrant parents with kids who were gang affiliated trying to, and that was all research based. And my recollection is that we found that through the U.S. Department of Justice resources, either the Criminal Justice Information Reference Service or the COPS office or the Office of Justice Programs, in addition to those other two sites that I referenced to you.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you talk some about domestic violence and how police officers respond to that and what would be a more effective way?
Well, this is really one of the randomized trials we did in my department was a second responder program to domestic violence. It's a very, very tragic phenomena for a variety of reasons, not only for the woman that's involved, but also because of what we know has the impact on children who witness interpersonal family violence. It has serious problems. There was a recent study, I can't remember who came out with this, but I saw it on the news, they were making reference to this, that kids in this one particular inner city had a higher level of PTSD than the kids in Baghdad that had studied. So there was a comparison study between what kids are seeing in that war-torn area versus the trauma that these kids were seeing as a result of family violence and inner city gun violence. So their trauma was higher. The science around this is a bit murky. The first iteration of evaluations on mandatory arrest policies that the police engaged in. The majority of police interaction in domestic violence is a reactive one. It happens after the event. It's very hard for the police to get into a household before something like that occurs. So the science is mostly about what do we do after we know about an incidence of domestic violence. Do we have a mandatory arrest or a not mandatory arrest? And the science is a bit conflicting about that. So the first one said you should arrest every offender in a domestic violence situation. Another randomized trial in another city, and that may be the thing that changed this, said that actually is counterproductive. It can increase the incidence of domestic violence downstream from that arrest incident. Then another study said, let's fine-tune this a little bit, and it was in another community where arresting people that have jobs has a greater, or the threat of that has a greater impact on the offender than an offender that is unemployed. And lastly, the study that we did was to try to reconcile two other studies about this second responder, which is a detective following up in an incidence of domestic violence after the police have been there. And as a result of that, we stopped our second response program. We found that we were creating more problems for the woman than if we had just left it alone after the first response. So sending detectives back to the household, reported by victims of, and this was a randomized trial, of domestic violence, created more problems for them than if we'd stayed away and just let the process of the first responder do that. So that is a practical example of how we use science to change our policy. We also got rid of our beat system as a result of the evidence about hotspots. But I'm not sure that enough study has been done, because there seems to be some geographic variability in how this happens, and that may be just the difference in how people perceive things. I'm trying to remember where these were. One of these was Minneapolis, and maybe another one was Chicago or Redlands, which is a smaller suburban community. So more science needs to be employed there. But the findings that exist today have direct and applicable teaching implications for police officers in terms of what they should do while they're there, whether there's an emerging notion of what's called parallel justice for victims of crime that relates to how the police and the system and the community deal with people who have been, by no fault of their own, victimized, and many of those are going to fall into that domestic violence category.
Thank you. I'd be very interested in following up with you on the research on that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, my contact information here is, and I can certainly give that to you.
Thank you.
Anything further, committee?
Thank you much, Mr. Brimmer. I would assume we're going to be hashing this over to be discussed more. A lot of information in a short time, but we appreciate it.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is a presentation of Senate Bill 267, Evidence-Based Treatment Programs, and looking forward to the next 10 years. I invite a testimony, Mr. Prinz.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and Chair Cruz and members of the committee, thank you so much, first of all, for having Chief Bierman speak to you about evidence-based policing. For the record, my name is Craig Prinz, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 267, but I just wanted to say that I think that Chief Bierman's comments, I think 267 is part of what would set Oregon up well to have something like the regional crime control centers he mentioned, because I think, you know, we don't even realize it. It's just like a goldfish in a bowl. We really started talking about science and the use of science to reduce crime and recidivism when you all passed Senate Bill 267 in 2003, and so I think that's part of it. So it's a nice connection to have the same things that we're now familiar with in a new context. And I just wanted to, I don't know if Chief Bierman or Kevin Campbell got to thank DPSST and State Police, and also I saw the criminology folks from PSU here, and it was a collaborative process to get them there, and I appreciate Representative Krieger's comments that it's something we can hash out and work on in the future as to what next steps to take on that. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to go into some really look at Sentinel 267 from the perspective of what is it, reminding ourselves of what it is since we've had it for 10 years, and kind of look at where we think we need to go with it for the next decade. And so just to remind y'all, Senate Bill 267 was passed in 2003. Chair Barker, I looked at the staff measure summary. I know you were on the House committee, as was Senator Prezansky, was then a state rep. We're on the House committee that passed Senate Bill 267. And Senate Bill 267 was really one of the similarities. It was from the last recession we had. I don't know what we would call that one now, maybe a small dip, but at the time we were dealing with these same issues of less revenue for a lot of the programs that we'd invested in. And so Senate Bill 267 was an attempt to really reallocate funding in the area of crime prevention, interventions at OIA or DOC, and treatment funds that were invested by the Department of Human Services to reduce crime or mental health services, the use of those. And if you'll recall it, it really, I think, incorporated the same lens that Chief Bierman talked about, which was basically using scientifically based research that has been proven in the literature to be cost effective, and using that to really guide our investments. So we're really relying on science more than our best intentions, our gut feelings, our anecdotal evidence. And it was really driven more by, you know, what has been proven to be effective in all of these studies from around the nation and actually internationally. So what it did is it directed agencies to invest, beginning in 2005, to invest 25% of the funding for these purposes of reducing crime into that type of scientifically based program. And then in 07 it was 50%, and then in the 09 session and hereafter it's 75% of the funding. And it also directed the agencies to make a report to you all, this committee, on September 30th of this year. So they will be making that report. My comments are not the individual agency reports. It's more of an overview and to look at it. So here are the agencies that will be reporting to you on September 30th. And I wanted to thank, there's folks from each agency here in case there you have any follow-up questions. They'll be available. So why did we emphasize evidence-based programs? I think, again, Chief Bierman has called some of these things out with some of the random control trials and other trials that he's aware of and have done to make sure what we're doing works, basically, to have the very best, just like in an investment portfolio, just have the very best strongly, you know, that what we're doing is going to have the outcomes we intend them to. My memory, my background is I was a deputy district attorney in Portland for Mike Shrunk at Multnomah County DA's office for 5 years, and then worked in the legislature with this committee. I was committee counsel when 267 went through. I remember it. I remember what you all were confronted with, and I remember the phrase that that we were talking about was, when we have less resources, if we have less revenue, are we going to just let the soup be thinned, or are we going to try to cull the herd? And I think 267 was an attempt at what we would call culling the herd. In other words, trying to identify things that we invest in that, for lack, you know, to take that in metaphor, are sick. They're not working. And the ones that I remember us talking about in 03 was boot camps, that we had some boot camps that the literature was really saying a military boot camp doesn't have an indication of, from the way we were doing them at the time, to reduce recidivism. And I remember Scared Straight was one we were looking at. I don't think the state invested in Scared Straight, but it was an example at that time of not only did, you know, a lot of things we were investing in at the time had no science around them. Scared Straight and Boot Camp had science to show that they did not work. And so that's really what I remember from the time of why we focused on evidence-based programs and kind of some of the intentions we all had at that time. So the benefits we can see from the last 10 years. Oregon is highlighted nationally. I go to national conferences. I'm through managing the federal grants that are managed by the Office of Justice Programs, the folks that have the crimesolutions.gov webpage, Center Witsit, that Chief Bierman mentioned to you. I know that they it has really raised the profile in Oregon of using design and evaluation. So when we're going to invest in something, or if I know from your questions, we hear the question, why are you doing this? Is there a scientific basis for what you're doing? That's a huge leap forward. Many states don't have that. And Oregon, I think, was the first to do this type of statutory change. I think a few states have followed us, but I really think it really is in keeping with that Oregon model of pioneering and looking at things differently. Really what Senate Bill 267 is really similar to what Chief Bierman's talking about with policing. It connects the local, just like we connect the local chief to this body of information that's been culled out of rigorous evaluations. 267 takes a local county or tribal service and it connects it to this broad array of literature that criminologists have developed to determine what works. It unifies the agencies and gives us a framework to talk about things, again, that Chief Bierman mentioned, which are things like, how good is this evaluation? What's the effect size of, you know, is there a control group and a treatment group? I mean, I can tell you that law school does not teach you those things, that where my training background is. I don't think we train that for, you know, the folks that run this system and as the judges and district attorneys and defenders. And I don't think that's something that we talked about really for those who become the treatment providers. And so it's this basis in science has really unified us and give us a way to speak about this. I think the other thing that we've seen is the way you all have allowed the agencies to work with the individual counties and tribes and treatment providers, it's really given enough flexibility to make sure we are not being unrealistic with what kind of resources there are at the local level, so that we acknowledge that in a rural county, for example, there might be only one treatment provider anyways to work with, and so you have to work with them and try to move them along on assuring that it's a good investment. The biggest benefit, I think, is that we see that we can reduce recidivism, and several studies have shown, by implementing a well-designed program and then focusing on how it's presented and how it's done. And I think there's examples in many of your counties on how that's been done. We see that in Washington State, the Washington State Institute of Public Policy has also shown that this type of investment saves taxpayers. The estimate that I saw in Washington was that it saved $2 billion in that the long-term costs avoided, really just like a stock investment when the stock market is going up, it compounds over time and you can really see a reward from being more effective. There's also challenges that we've seen in the last 10 years. And I would say the main challenges are that you always have to customize, you know, this thing that was studied in Baltimore or Stockton or wherever, you have to customize it to fit to the population in Oregon. And so these are, in the way that the folks talk about that would do this, it'd be the responsivity issues that you have to deal with. For example, barriers to treatment, like what's the learning style, the gender, the culture, if it's different from what it was as it was designed and evaluated. You always have to make sure that you're customizing to some extent. If you're dealing with someone with a lower IQ or things like that than what it was studied on. And we realize that's really the tension of 267 at this point, is how much flexibility and how rigid should the agencies be in working on the county, tribal, and non-profit providers that do it. It can't be a one-size fits all, but there does need to be accountability at the local level, and we can talk about some of those things. One thing I think that's we've occasionally run into, again, when you've got one provider working with the Department of Corrections, Oregon Youth Authority, and the Oregon Health Authority to serve different populations with different needs, we sometimes will be giving that one provider three different directions, because we do have different populations. So that can be a challenge too that we've really worked through, and I think we've come a long way on cooperating on that. So I just want to talk about the next decade of where I think we are going to be focusing in the next decade. And I think I'm going to go through this myself, but I wanted to say that the Criminal Justice Commission, our purpose has really evolved to becoming the folks that can assist the individual agencies and lend some objectivity to what I would call fidelity studies, and I'll explain what those are, partnering on outcome studies, and I think Chief Bierman mentioned those, performance management, and then cost-benefit analysis, so we can translate all of this back into taxpayer savings, and savings that really accrues to the individual victim. If we can avoid victims, that is the goal of all of this, and if we can do that more efficiently, that's the goal of all of these folks that work on this. And so I've got Stephen Carter is an economist that works in my office. I hired him recently when Mike Wilson became a consultant. And Greg Lay has worked in Oregon Youth Authority and the Department of Correction on the type of fidelity studies that I'm going to talk about. And I really see that in talking with the agencies in some detail. These are kind of the next steps that we need to do to assure that we're moving forward and constantly trying to improve our programs. So the first thing is a fidelity study. What is a fidelity study? It's a focus on how making sure the program is appropriately and effectively incorporating the design of what it was meant to do. In corrections, this is really going to be, is there an actuarial risk assessment? Do they then focus on those who are moderate to high risk to recidivate? Are the ones that are most likely to be committing crime when they're on probation, off probation, released from prison? Making sure that the individual drivers, which we call needs, are assessed. So is it substance abuse? Is it antisocial peers? Really, it's an individualized look at this. You have to do those, and then make sure you have the third principle of kind of corrections, responsivity, making sure that you have a adequate way to work with that that individual offender to address those issues. It also is just basic things like who's providing the program, what's their training, what kind of supervision and feedback on the staff themselves. So fidelity is really looking at the staff who present the program, how are they doing it, and in these environments with the recession, we really need to look at things like ongoing training. Are we able to afford that, or is it inadequate? What's the caseload of the folks who are trying to do this evidence-based program? And making sure we're always measuring performance and we're holding accountable not just the offenders, but ourselves, making sure that we don't drift. A lot of us, we can see, you like to just say, yeah, it's an evidence-based program. It's kind of like a brand name. You get to put on a box like Wheaties, and hopefully folks will buy that program. You need to do more than that. You need to make sure that what is being done on an ongoing basis really does not drift away from that curriculum. And I think that's critical, and I think it's shown that if you do that, if you focus on that, you're going to have much better results. Outcome studies have got to be a part of moving forward with something like Senate Bill 267. An outcome study is what Chief Bierman was talking about with a random controlled trial. That's the gold standard. That's like a medical trial where you'd have a placebo and a drug. It's very difficult to do those in the criminal justice setting when you think about the ethics of saying, I'm going to give you guys treatment and you're not going to get any and I'm going to see how that goes. You have to be very, very careful how you do that. You work with a university to make sure it's reviewed by a board and it's acceptable how you do that. We also use the electronic data we have to do what we would call a matched pair comparison group, so we can look and identify someone who's in the treatment that's receiving the program, and we can identify a very similar offender, and we can match them in the same county and see which, you know, how different the recidivism rates are. That is all necessary. You have to do those on an ongoing basis. Oregon's got good folks that can work with the agencies, like the Oregon Social Learning Center, PSU, Western Oregon, Southern Oregon University. We also have nonprofit groups like NPC Research in Portland, Echo Northwest. There are firms that can do outcome studies. They're very expensive. They're very time-consuming. Really what you're looking at is, we're going to do an intervention here, and it's going to take 3 years to really to see, you know, how differently did these groups, this group recidivate from that group, and you have to target them, and you can't do every one. But you learn so much when you do your own work like this. So outcome studies have to be a part of this as you move forward. You can't overlook just basic performance management, making sure, for example, I would say that you have your finger on the pulse of the treatment. In other words, you don't want to just kind of invest the money, do a fidelity study occasionally, and say, we're going to do an outcome study in 3 years. You really want to make sure that you're monitoring on the ground, you know, what's the staff saying, what are the clients saying, how are we meeting just the basic thing, like how many people are failing out of the program? You have to, this is kind of that constant monitoring. This would be the management part of management, and just like a business, it's just a nonprofit business that's designed to reduce crime rather than have a profit. And then the last part of what I think 267 calls us to is that we have to assure ourselves that the programs that we invest in are cost effective. Cost-benefit analysis is a way to speak the language of business in what we're buying in crime. You're looking at what's the return on investment for this investment. This is the language, for example, on the Commission on Public Safety that Representative Garrett's on. Dick Withnell is our business, you know, member of the public. This is constantly what he's asking: is what's the cost benefit of investing in programs that really work? You're monetizing the benefits to the victim, to the taxpayers, of avoiding crime. We look at national literature, try to identify as best we can when a victim of crime is hurt. You know, there's lost job. They go to the hospital. They may have to be in treatment physically or psychologically. And there are national studies to try to estimate that cost to the victim. We can also look at the cost to the system when we avoid a arrest, when we avoid a commitment to the corrections authority or the Oregon Youth Authority. We avoid a conviction. You avoid the cost of the district attorney, the courts. All the parts of our system, if we can have one less crime that's actually committed. So we look at the cost of the program, we look at the gross savings, and then we make a net savings after we take the cost to the benefits of having avoided crime through recidivism, and we subtract the cost of the program, and we try to get a net savings from it. This is an example. I think most of you are going to be familiar with the work of the Washington State Institute of Public Policy. They started doing this in 2006. I think it's the best example of applied research in this area. Basically, this chart gives you an example of how these calculations are made. My office, my agency, has partnered with the Washington State Institute of Public Policy. We have the tool they use, and we have used it for Oregon programs. This is an example from Washington. You look at all that evaluation, you get an example of the effect that you can expect. We call it the effect size. That's typically how much prevention you're buying, how much reduction in recidivism you're buying, and you can look at that in juvenile justice, which is the example here. You can look at it in early childhood. You can look at it in the criminal justice system. In this, we have in blue the savings, the total savings to the taxpayers and the non-taxpayers of those avoided crimes. And the non-taxpayers, again, would be one less victim as we do this, and then many victims avoided on a scale. You have the costs of the program. That's one of the, a lot of work goes into how much is the cost per participant. It takes a lot of collaboration with the counties, tribes, and providers. And then you take in red, basically, okay, so what's the net benefit? And then you take and you can develop a ratio of what was invested in the program and what's the bang for your buck. I will say you can't just say, well, I'm going to put everything into aggression replacement training because that has the highest. You also have to look at how quickly you can scale it, what's the need for that type of thing. You can then get a rate of return on your investment. And also, one of the new things that Washington State Institute's Public Policy has done is the last column, which really they can look at the rigor of the evaluations, how many evaluations have been done, the effect size, and they will run a model to see how often do you get a positive return. It's a measure of risk. And you can see Scared Straight is the example where there is no benefit. It does have a low cost, but there can't be a benefit-cost ratio to them. You can see that it has a 1% chance of reducing crime. So with anything, every once in a while, there is an opportunity to, even something like Scared Straight could affect one kid. We really think that moving forward, an opportunity to maximize 267. If you think of 267, really the accountability is focused on the agencies. The agencies need to hit, are you doing 75% at this point of your funding from the general fund? Is it going into proven programs? We really think that working more collaboratively with incentives, program incentives, and with those counties that work with us is helpful. I think some of the agencies are doing that. And that is, I think, something that's consistent in all of state government. We're really moving away from allotment discussions of we're going to give you blank dollars per head per day to provide a service, to we're really looking more at what are we buying as an outcome? How can we incentivize the outcome we want to reach? And we've seen a lot of we've had a lot of good success with having people from different counties, for example, come together and peer review each other's programs. They learn from the program. They learn to trust each other. And so we've seen a lot of good feedback in ensuring effectiveness when we have a shared evaluation model, a peer review model of all the folks that we are investing in with different counties.
Good.
So I'm just going to real quickly move through again, the individual agencies. that make the 267 report to you. Their reports are due in a couple weeks at the end of the month. And I, addictions and mental health, for this large agency, which a lot of the addiction treatment that's purchased and the prevention services are purchased are not designed for crime specifically. In alcohol and drugs, a lot of the money is going into clients in the DUIs. That's one of the predominant areas where they're referred from the criminal justice system. Obviously, for adult mental health services, it would be clients who are in danger to themselves or others and at risk of hospitalization due to mental illness. And then for children, it would be those child and adolescents with severe emotional disorders who are at risk for hospitalization. Right now, AMH estimates that 82% of the treatment dollars that they're spending are on evidence-based programs. And the key, of course, in this area is how the changes in this delivery system for future biennia with what Dr. Goldberg and you and Governor Kitzhaber are working on, how OHA is going to move forward, and it's this concept, again, of purchasing performance. And they will be encouraging the use of evidence-based program to achieve those goals. For the Youth Development Council, this is formerly known as the Commission on Children and Families. These are where you're doing what would be called, predominantly doing what's called general prevention. So you're identifying youth in the communities that have risk factors. I think Chief Bierman talked about the risk factors for gangs, you know, family issues, substance abuse issues of themselves or their families. You identify those folks, and you work with the counties and tribes to fund the services for them in their local juvenile justice system. You can see the types of interventions we're talking about. What they've seen is they've looked at how many youth they can serve with the juvenile crime prevention funds over time, and they can track over, they look at their outcomes over 6 months and every year to try to see how many of the folks that they've targeted as having a risk to get involved in crime, how many of them are staying crime free. I think this shows that, you know, the criminal justice system, obviously we focus on a small percentage of the total population who really get involved in crime, and our felony and correction system is focused on a really small group. But the good news is the Youth Development Council is an area to invest in young kids, young people, to give them research-based, gender-specific prevention work to make sure that you're working with their family and working with the resources in the community to make sure they do not even get involved. And the other two areas, the last two areas, are the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority. The Department of Corrections, we broke it up into really looking at how 267 is applied in the prisons and then how it's applied with the 36 counties in how people are supervised on probation or after prison. In the prison programming, you really have the general fund programs where four programs showed to be satisfactory, very satisfactory, one satisfactory, and one was not reviewed. This is by using a checklist to see, again, how it's implemented and those things I mentioned on fidelity. So DOC will be reporting in their report that they've met the requirements of 267. They also have take it upon themselves to look at the programs that are funded with inmate welfare programs. So this is when an inmate buys things like a cup of soup or a chocolate bar or whatever from the cantina. That money is then invested in programs designed to reduce recidivism as well. And they've looked at those, and you can see three of those programs. Two were very satisfactory, and one needed improvement. And we're really trying to automate how we do these assessments so they're less staff intensive, so that we can, again, do some of that, the work of getting a control group and a treatment group and doing ongoing monitoring with the robust computer systems that DOC has. Community corrections is where the money is then spent in the counties, and also in the the nexus between when the person, planning the point where a person leaves the prison and goes into a county supervision or when they're placed on probation. You can see that there's more programs out there. One of the things with 267 is as the agency moves away from something that they control themselves, there has to be more collaboration. It's a little more difficult to do this. And a low score, we found, just means we need to work to change it. It doesn't mean we should just play, you know, Caesar and say, you know, off with their head. And if the county or the program will work with them, you know, all these assessments mean is how well are they doing and can they really improve? And you can see many are doing very satisfactory and some need improvement and some are unsatisfactory. I believe that shows that this is taken seriously and that the counties are working with DOC to work on those. The DOC is really working in this area too with fewer staff resources, exploring how they can do this ongoing fidelity study as you know, in a less intensive as far as staffing to make sure that we're targeting those community treatment programs and supervision. I think this is a really interesting slide, and this shows the blue line is recidivism from the prisons, and the black line is where 267 started to require for the biennium from July 05 to July 07 that agencies like DOC invest in evidence-based programs. And I'm not saying that this is a causal relationship. I just think it's important to note our recidivism rate has been dropping out of prison. It's that blue line there. And then the red line would be the, we call them cohorts. They're the folks that were placed on supervision, and the red line would be probation starting in July 2005. And the last one we have are the cohorts in July 2008, because we followed them for 3 years after they are released from prison or put on supervision on probation. And I'm really pleased to see that the probation, the recidivism rates have been dropping since those biennium where we started to do 267. The Oregon Youth Authority, in a similar vein to the Department of Corrections, has both closed custody facilities. It's easier to review those because, again, they're right there in your own employees and your own facilities. They've reviewed 80% qualified as highly effective or effective. I know that the director of OYA is very motivated to work on this type of thing and has been working with research folks from his own agency, some of whom are here in Department of Corrections, to make sure that we're doing all we can to really rehabilitate the youth who are then put in the programs there. The residential programs, you can see they've also been reviewed. Most are highly effective. And there are some that have not been yet reviewed at the community level that they're going to be focusing on and we'll talk about in their individual reports. And I'll just leave you with a slide that from OYA. I think this comes back to 267 is really going through this, all five of these steps. You want to make, yes, you want to say, you know, is there science out there that tells us, like an investment portfolio, what should we be investing in? There's a strong reason to believe it will be effective. You then have to do fidelity studies to make sure what you bought is actually what's being carried out. You need to look at the progress in treatment. That's that ongoing management. You have to have your fingers on the pulse, make sure that the case planning's going on. You need to make sure that they have folks in the programs and they're not having, you know, some type of problem from the outset. You then want to do outcome studies so you can learn about what you're doing, get an effect size. That's the very best way to show that our taxpayer dollars are working to reduce recidivism. And the way we do that, and what OYA has really been focusing on, is making sure we're matching the right youth to the right service by assessment, getting a assessment of what they need, how much dosage they need, and making sure we have the appropriate resource for them. And we pull that all together through an economist to report back to you, those who are actually buying these services, the funders of this for the taxpayers, to report back on it whether or not it's cost effective. So that's a rundown on where I see the next 10 years. I really appreciate the time for this presentation and for the prior presentation. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them or direct you to the folks on my staff or within the agencies who could answer them for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Prinz, we've been doing this for 10 years now. Mm-hmm. Are we incarcerating fewer people per capita, and are we supervising fewer people per capita mm-hmm. than we were 10 years ago? Mm-hmm. And the second question is, have we used the same definition for recidivism for the last 10 years, mm-hmm. which is, I believe, committed or convicted in misdemeanor within 3 years?
Correct. Co-chairs, Chair Cruz, Senator Wittsitt, great questions. We are incarcerating more people than we had in 2003. I know that from 2000 till today, we've increased a 47% and increased the number of people in prison. I think that has to do mostly with baseline population growth of our whole state, has to do with sentencing and policy changes.
With per capita.
Per capita.
Yes.
Yeah. And let me make sure I understand your...
The question was, are we incarcerating or supervising more people per capita?
Oh, excuse me. I did... Senator Wittsitt, thank you for that clarification. Yes, we are. We are, and I think that has to do with a lot with... So that would take care. It's not just baseline growth, but a lot of it's policies that we've implemented. And also, we've seen that, I think the second part of your question, we've seen recidivism dropping, but we've also, I think, for example, in Klamath County, great programs that have been done by your folks there in Klamath County, but a lot of those have been shut down because of revenue is just not there. So the concern is, where are we going to be going in the next 10 years? And so I think it's connecting these things as a overall system I think we can do better with. I hope that, and I think you had the second part of your question, sir, I might have forgot, I apologize.
Definition of recidivism, the same?
Thank you for that. The definition of recidivism that we use for the Department of Corrections and for the Oregon Youth Authority, they're the key performance measure targets that are set for them for the legislature. So OYA will have to I think it's referrals is what you're looking at there. They'll have to tell you. I'm not as acquainted with that because I'm more in criminal justice. I can tell you it has not changed. It's that felony conviction within 3 years of being released from the prison or placed on supervision, and that has been consistent. And we also, of course, do different recidivism measures along the way, but that's the key one that's being reported and has not changed.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Prinz.
Good morning.
Regarding the county's reliance on the state as their criminal justice solution, there seems to be vast disparity. I think when last we talked, it was between 13% and 35%, depending on which county you go to, send their felons to prison. Because some counties send 13% of their felons to prison. Other Oregon counties send 35%.
That's right.
Any comments on that? Why the disparity?
Oh, I co-chairs and Senator Cruz and members of the committee, Representative Hicks, you and I are both very familiar with Grants Pass. It's where you're from. It's where I'm from. Went to high school. It's where my parents still live. And so I watch Josephine County, for example, very closely. I mean, I just think that where we are with some of the counties, you can see when there's not very many choices mm-hmm. about what you do with someone who's committed a felony, you're going to have to send them to prison more often, I believe. I think Lane County is confronted with the same thing, and I think this is going to be exacerbated in the Timber County reliant counties, where there's just not very many options for the judges and DAs to look at in the way to address someone. So when you have those disparities in services, you're going to have those disparities in how the system's used. Representative Barker worked with Portland Police for years. Portland has just so many more services. They have more funds to invest they tend to have, they actually have a lower, rate to prison, even with a higher crime rate than some of the counties that okay. There really are not as many options. So I think we're going to unfortunately see that trend continue unless we really do a good job of reinvesting funds in those areas. And it's a difficult, difficult conversation, but I just see that being a key. I think when we... when we did 1145 in 1997, we were so focused on making sure that the state adequately, made sure they did what they said they were going to do. And I know we can all argue, is that adequate even at this point? But what we're seeing in the timber counties is there's just really nothing else, I think, in some of these counties than that state investment, because there's not the revenue that the county would have had from logging receipts in my hometown in Grants Pass, I can tell you, and really the payments going away. So it's a trend that we're all aware of and when we're concerned about, but I think that's that dynamic. I don't know if you agree.
Thank you.
Yes.
One more. Thank you. Thank you. That was a wonderful comment. And I mean, just to highlight, between the sentencing, the grid, the guidelines, and the ballot measures, in a lot of these counties, say a meth dealer with minimal criminal history is going to get zero jail time, will never spend a day behind bars, whereas someone who commits their fourth theft, purely property crime, nothing else on the record, will go to prison and do every day of their jail time. Right. And they will also, by the way, have all the access to the services that the state at the moment is able to provide or is providing. So, I mean, we are seeing, I think, a vast disparity in what we'd commonly call justice.
That's right. If I can follow up, co-chairs and Senator Cruz and committee members, Representative Hick, I think that's right. You lose any sureness of a penalty, the swiftness of a penalty, when you don't have a jail to hold someone in after, you get them cited, arraigned, they're out. And so we all know that to deter crime, you're looking at swiftness, sureness, and severity. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when the county cannot provide that front-end local system adequately, really the only response is what we would predominantly would have kept as the severe penalty, which is going to state prison. And the way we've got it designed right now, of course, if a guy goes to state prison, for the county commissioners, I'm not saying it doesn't impact their bottom line in the county the way it would to try to keep the jail open. And that's unfortunate, because we all know that that's a more efficient, effective way to deter crime, is to have that local system. And I really think that we should look at how we make that structural relationship between the state and the counties, I just really think has to be addressed when we look at our current situation financially.
Okay, thanks.
President Schaffler.
Well, I'm not surprised anyone here, but future legislatures are going to have to deal with this, and there is a solution, and we all know what it is. And it's let those folks take advantage of their natural resources and their water and their land. And I hope future legislatures are listening and come here and vote accordingly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Cruz.
Yeah. Is there still only two counties that opted out of 1145, Douglas and Lynn, yep. I believe, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. Co-chair, that's correct. So it's really interesting, because it's really not the opt-out now. It's more... Even though the state is able to provide that community corrections grant at what we minimally require to avoid opt-out, it's just not enough when you reduce, when the county just doesn't have the revenue. But so, yes, it's just Lynn and Benton still that have opted out. But
and Douglas.
I'm sorry, Douglas. I said Benton. Lynn and Douglas County, excuse me, Senator.
And my conversations with our county commissioners is they think it was the best move they could have made, and there's no way in the world they'd want to come back in. So I that was an attempt we made to level things, and I'm not sure it was all that successful. I think Representative Hicks has got a good point. I mean, I think Josephine is going to go up to 60 beds, I think, something like that.
39.
Okay.
Federal money.
And for the 18 timber counties, the future is not looking any better. at this point in time. And interestingly enough, we have a county payments task force tomorrow, I think, or is it later today, one of the two. But this has got to be an issue because ultimately the state's on the hook for this stuff.
Co-chairs and Senator Cruz, I think that's right. We don't want a situation where there's, you know, pockets of the state that cannot provide adequate public safety services. I think this is what Governor Kitzhaber and Senator Courtney and the Speaker really, you know, we're trying to figure out how we can reinvest in those local public safety systems. I think it's critical. We're looking at how to control the prison population so there's not more money going into that system if that's not the most efficient. And really looking at these structural relationships that you mentioned with 1145 and things and saying, is this the best we can do? Can we do a better job of making sure we have adequately invested or reinvested in these areas? And it's a challenge, of course, with state revenues where they are, but I think that's the challenge that we're all going to be facing, whether we like to or not.
There's some dominoes here, and we haven't talked Curry at this point, but you know, a county at this point in time, all they can do is become insolvent. They don't have any other options on the table, and the first thing that goes is shared services, and public safety is just one of that basket.
That's an option.
Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Prince, could you tell us why we use felony as a measure of recidivism?
Yeah.
I know that's been an issue lately. So.
Absolutely. Co-chairs, Senator Cruz, members of the committee, felony reconviction is used because it really is a performance management for Department of Corrections. Department of Corrections is who deals with felons on probation or in the prison. So the thought is, because I know when we worked on making that the key performance measure, that's what you're asking the agency to look at reducing is the people that they actually touch. And so felony reconviction has been used for that purpose. 3 years has been used for a long time. I think that also is the best way to look at it because in the sense of some states and others look at whether a person got was sent back to prison. I think that has a lot more to do with state policies. Someone could commit a felony and not go back to prison. And so I think it's an honest measurement. It's not a perfect measurement. But I think it's built that way so you're actually measuring the performance of that agency because that's who they deal with.
Just a comment. You know, Mr. Chair, I'd like to be identified with Representative Schaffler's comments. When we get into the rural areas of the state, we don't have funds. The counties don't have funds. The cities don't have funds because we've been denied the use of our natural resources, the timber, the water, agricultural lands and practices, minerals, oil and gas, even geothermal and biomass are getting hammered on. I mean, anytime we try to use our natural resources, we have legislators and NGOs alike coming in and hammering us to keep us from doing that. We cannot recover without using those natural resources, and Oregon can't recover without using those natural resources.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Chair Mark, thank you very much for letting me speak.
The next topic is going to be reporting House Bill 3124. Bill, do you have any comments about what you found looking into this before we start?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, historically there's some interesting issues here, okay, and that is possession of a gambling device is a Class A misdemeanor. And a gambling device is a machine that pays off the money. Possession of a gray machine, a machine that pays off on additional games, is a Class C felony.
And I think that's probably developed for historical reasons. The issue of gray machines came up as we started to put video poker machines to the Lottery Commission in bars and taverns. I can remember before that going to a golf course down in Seaside, and they had a video poker machine there that supposedly paid off in games, but if you knew the bartender, they paid you off in cash. And I think that that distinction came in as we developed the Lottery Commission and the trade-off between having video poker machines in bars and taverns versus the gray machines. But it is an anomaly in the sense that the penalty for possessing something that does not pay off in money, a gray machine, which theoretically is an amusement and entertainment, is more severe than possessing the same device that pays off in money. But there are historical reasons for that tied to the lottery. That's basic history that I can ascertain from reading the two statutes and understanding the historical context in which they were both passed.
Mr. Martin, would you like to come up with your people?
Co-chairs and members of the Judiciary Committee, I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here. I know you have time limits and you heard a lot of stuff this morning, and so we'll try to be as quick as possible. The background, and only Representative Schaffler remembers this issue because his committee dealt with it rather than the Judiciary Committee.
We're going to have to figure out who you are.
I'm Roger Martin. I'm a lobbyist for the Oregon Association of Amusement and Music Operators Association. And with me is Lee Prantl, who is the president of that organization and lives here in Salem. The organization is an organization of small businessmen that distribute various kinds of machines, some of which are entertainment devices. They sell independent ATM machines to locations that want to have an ATM machine that aren't banks. They do those kind of things. They've been in existence for a long time, and I've represented them for many years. They are the true small businessmen, not terribly sophisticated when it comes to legal issues, but they're law-abiding, and they follow the law. Our problem starts last session. We introduced House Bill 3124. It went to Representative Schaffler's committee. Probably should have been a judiciary, but the presiding officer of the House, the officers of the House, said that committee, your committee on judiciary, was stuffed with all kinds of things, so we'll send it to the other committee. The bill started off, what it was an attempt to simply distinguish that amusement devices, such as the advertisement you see there, were not gambling devices. We got crosswise with the state police and the lottery. Decision was made to form a study committee to work during the interim. We have met three times during the interim, and the conclusion was we couldn't come to a decision. The state police, when we offered ideas, said we don't write the laws, the legislature does, we just enforce the law. And the law dates from 1991, when video poker became a big state operation. There was a fear because, as you will hear, and anybody can tell you, gray games, as Bill Taylor just mentioned, gray games existed. They were video poker games that bars and taverns had all over the state of Oregon, and some of them paid off and some of them didn't. The state was in the business. How do we keep competition out? We passed a gray game statute. And unfortunately, the penalty for that was a felony. Now, there's a reason. Nobody knew how the lottery was going to develop any more than we knew how casino gambling on the Indian reservations would develop. So it was a great security question. The legislature made it a felony and owned a gray game. Are there gray games left in Oregon? Yes, there are a whole bunch of them that aren't owned by the state. They're owned by all the tribal reservation gambling casinos. Are there any others? No, they're in Idaho. Now our argument gets down to, is that device you've seen, which is an amusement device, is that a gray game? We adamantly think it is not, and common sense would tell you it was not. I'll defy any of you. Go in a bar someplace, or wherever they have, or we'll show them to you, and you will find out. As as some legislators have already. You don't gamble on these machines. It's amusement alone. But our argument gets down to this. Now, the effect of this, and I want to use one illustration. A year and a half ago, Michael Dantu, who is a member of our organization, has a small business on Northeast Columbia Boulevard. On a Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, he was working in the back of his shop on a machine of some kind, and his employee came back and said, "Michael, the state police are here." He walked out. They said to him, "Mr. Dantu, you're under arrest on a charge, felony charge. You have the right," gave him read him his rights, put handcuffs on him, and drove him out to Hillsborough to the Washington County Jail and put him in jail. He was there for 4 hours until they could get the bail and everything. He got out. He had to go straight to a hospital because Michael Dantu is a diabetic. And he went into diabetic shock. He was so petrified. I've never had that experience. I'm sure none of you have. But a small businessman, and what was the charge? There was a machine in Banks, Oregon that the state police decided. It was an amusement device. It was a gambling device, and he was under arrest for that. 1 week later, the district attorney in Washington County said, "I'm not going to prosecute that. It's not anything that makes any sense to me. I'm dropping the charges. I won't prosecute it." We're still trying to get the machine back because it was picked up as evidence. Those machines cost $3,500. We have machines in the Portland area that have been confiscated 4 years ago. I've talked to the DA in Multnomah County and in Clackamas County. I don't have to tell you how busy the district attorneys are and how understaffed they are. They're never going to get to the level of prosecuting that. But effectively, the state police have taken the machine and confiscated it. Now, we need some help on solving something. You've spent 2 hours listening to evidence-based policing. And I think the basis of that must be common sense. So I urge you, would you all help us using a little common sense to try to get this thing changed so we don't have this ongoing argument with the state police? And I'm very sorry to be in an argument with the state police because when I was in your position, when some of you were in grade school, as a legislator, I was the state police go-to guy in the House of Representatives. And I don't like to be in this kind of argument with them now.
I don't feel bad. I argue with them.
I would like Lee to give you one further example of what we're talking about. Lee Prandtl from...
Co-Chairman Krieger and Co-Chair Barker, isn't it? Thank you for your time. So I'm representing two people. I'm representing my company, which is Pride Vending. We operate...
Sir, could you say your name, though, so that they have it on the tape?
Yeah, my name is Lee Prandtl.
Thank you.
And I'm the president of Pride Vending in Salem. We operate games in the Salem area. But I'm also representing the Oregon Amusement Operators because I'm the president of that small group. But the big problem is it seems like the rules are always changing. Going back about 5 years ago, Lieutenant Tim Steiner called me. He was the head of the enforcement of the gaming department at that time, and he said, "I understand that you're operating possibly a gambling game." So I met him right up the street at the Cue Ball, which is a billiard hall, and he came in with another officer, and we looked at the game, and it was called Chug 21. And after some time, he said, "That isn't a gambling game." He says, "You know, there isn't even a dealer that you're playing against. All you're doing is adding up beer mugs till they hit 21, and that's it. You can't win a game or anything like that." So he said, "That's no problem." Well, years later, now they are prosecuting us for that particular game, which is Chug 21. Those are some of the games that, like, that we're talking about that have been picked up, and the people have been, a felony is charged with them. And it's just pretty tough on these small businesses. Some of them have had 3-4 games picked up, and we don't know from time to time what game they're going to pick up. We assume it's okay, then we go back and say, no, you can't play that game because it has the word 21 or it's got the word 31. So it's kind of a moving target for us, and it's really, really tough, and we'd really like to have some clarity on it if it's all possible.
Second Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So is there a charge for people to play these games?
It is. They're typically 25 cents or, yeah.
Follow-up. Is there a reward for
that? Absolutely not.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an interesting concept, and I want to be the first one to be supportive of our lottery and lottery inspectors and the state police who do a great job out there. They are stuck interpreting this law, and this body has not given them clarification of the law. since then, I've been known to stop into a bar and have a beer every now and then. I don't want anybody to be surprised about that. These machines are all over the place. They're ubiquitous. You could literally go into every tavern in this state and pull it out and put that owner in jail, the distributor and the owner, because they could both go to jail and it'd be a felony, as Mr. Taylor went. Nobody, there's no way you can pay out on this. It's impossible. They can barely keep up with the lottery machines. Now, I'm not beating up on the state police. They've interpreted the law. God bless them. This body needs to add clarification. By the way, a pinball machine you can win games on. So there is a reward. Are we going to go yard out every single pinball machine in every child arcade in this state? Maybe it's accepted. Maybe it's exempt in the statute. But, Mr. Chair, these are not criminals. And I did have breakfast with the gentleman that Roger was talking about, and he's just a businessman like everybody else. Now, this is just absurd. They're not. They're everywhere too. They're everywhere. So I hope this body, in all its wisdom, can clarify this for these good people and let them go out and keep people working in Oregon. By the way, which is what we need, not less people working.
Chair, and perhaps Mr. Martin or Mr. Frample can either confirm or correct my recollection. The state police have two officers dedicated to enforcing these gray laws, these machines?
There's a number of them. I'm sure there's more than two. There's one in Salem, and I know there's one on the coast. And No, there's a number of them. Yeah.
Is it 14?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's 14 officers that that exclusively enforce these machines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, the state police are probably going to testify and they can give you the details of how many officers they have. To our knowledge, and the Game Enforcement Division does a lot of other things besides this. This is just the one area that we're concerned about. I should add, in our three meetings with the state police and the lottery, the state police suggested a mechanism that they thought they could work with, which was to have an independent testing laboratory, happens to be back east, examine these games and charge a fee and rule whether they were, in their opinion, gambling or not. We reject that for two reasons. Number one, the business, even though Representative Schaffler says they're ubiquitous, the distributors will tell you they're not very high volume, and some of the distributors simply got out of the business because it's too much of a hassle. It also would institute a program, and I've been around here long enough to know, you start a program and charge a fee, it's going to be here forever as a source of revenue. And just use one example. When I was in the legislature and Portland area had horrible smog, we instituted vehicle inspection program. Now, most common sense people would tell you today's automobiles don't need that inspection program, but do you think you could possibly repeal the DEQ inspection program in Portland? We saw the same thing coming, and we just said, I'm sorry, we don't want to go there.
Okay, Schaffler, do you have another
question? Roger, the Game 31 was one of the games talked about. It's on every machine I've ever seen. I whether they're ubiquitous or everywhere, I don't know. But in some of the places I've been known to frequent, there's more football pools going on openly than any, and that's very illegal. And not that I participate, because I'm not much of a gambler. I'll do buy a Powerball ticket every now and then. But once again, you can win a game on a pinball machine. Every child's arcade in the state has pinball machines in it. Are they criminals? Should those proprietors be busted? It's just we're wasting our time, these people's time here, Mr. Chair. And on the DMV thing, the EQ, the federal law demands that we test our vehicles. Because we don't even need DEQ, by the way. We got DMV to do that. We got Division of State Lands, Ag, Water Resources. We don't even need DEQ at all. Quite frankly, I think we should just abolish the entire department. I wanted to throw that in there, too, as well, Mr. Chairman.
Now that you think you're not going to be coming back, you just tell it like it is, don't you?
Won't smoke, Mr. President.
Do you want to go ahead?
Thank you. Do we have any case law that I'm looking here at the definition of gambling device, gray machine, and gambling, as modified by the word that is actually defined unlawful. So that was nice of us to do that. But I'm just wondering, has the Court of Appeals or the Oregon Supreme Court waded into this morass to try and tell us what these things mean and how they apply to?
Mr. Chairman, Attorney Juan, I think that's an excellent question. And I think the answer is no, I won't guarantee that. The main reason being, we have never contested one of these arrests or these citations in a court of law. They've come before one court that I know of down in Clatsop County where they worked out an agreement and whoever it was settled for a misdemeanor charge or some other penalty, and it wasn't prosecuted. Our problem, we're convinced we would win in court, but it's like going to war with some corporation and paying huge legal fees, and nobody's wanted to do that. And if you are a bar owner and you've got one of these machines and you're charged, you're also probably, you have a liquor license and you have lottery machines, the last thing you want to do is get in a fight with them, so you just walk away from it. You don't argue it.
Follow-up, thank you. I'm kind of a fan of safe harbors. Am I thinking on the right track there for something that you guys could get behind? Drafting up a safe harbor, if your machine meets the following four criteria, you're safe.
That's basically what we were trying to do with House Bill 3124 in the last session, and we'd love it if you would do that again.
I was somewhat surprised that we couldn't get the state police to sit down and do that. And just as a brief comment to my co-chair, maybe it was inappropriate for them to be part of the work group. They are in the enforcement branch, not the policy-making branch. And so I think between now and December, we're going to get a couple people together. I want Bill Taylor to help and see. And we definitely need to have someone from the Senate side, maybe Chair Provansky, and take a look and see if we can't sit down and have a cup of coffee. I bet you in an hour we can fix it.
Mr. Chair, we would greatly appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I carried this bill on the floor. The definition of gaming or gambling, because the casino game, forgive me, Dice, Faro, Monte, Roulette, etc., there's actually some offensive things in here. Big Engine, Chinese Chuck Luck, I don't even know what those mean, but here's my favorite one, though. Beat the Banker.
Yeah. Any members in more comments or questions?
Martinez, you got this stuff, but I said that on the floor, too.
Thank you very much.
Any further on this topic?
State police need to come up. State police here, aren't they? Yeah. Okay, come on up, please.
I just want to say, as my co-chair said, that your job is to enforce the laws. We send them out, and so to have you try to set a policy was, I think, too, is inappropriate. We expect you to enforce the laws we send out. If we send out ambiguous laws, we get bad results. So.
That's exactly right.
Please state your names.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Durbin. Currently, I'm a captain with the Oregon State Police and served the last 10 years as the Gaming Enforcement Division Director, which oversees the security for the lottery, tribal casinos, Oregon Athletic Commission. With me today, I have Harold Lovejoy from the Department of Justice, and he was a member of the committee that was formed and also was the drafter of the process and the procedure that's being placed before you that was directed by House Bill 3124 when we worked with the Amusement Association. today, as been noted, I'm here to report back on the results of House Bill 3124 and what we did as directed to work to try to develop a procedure and try to develop a process by which these machines, basically as the representatives talked about, that there would be a safe harbor, there would be some type of affirmative defense going forward by these machines. We are talking about, and I think the industry would agree during those sessions, that a very small percentage of these games that are at issue. Overall, there is a vast majority of these games on it, as is talked about, a very large number of machines throughout the state, but there's a small amount of these games that are actually in question. So how would we go about looking at these games currently under the statutory concept and say that they are or are not meeting the definition of what would be considered a casino-style game, which is what is at issue and is the salient point? We met, as noted, several times, three times in particular. The first time we discussed these issues, and as noted, that the industry was really concerned about the statutory language and the way we're willing to work on the process, try to work on the procedure. Out of that, we took the recommendations from that meeting and went back to try to draft a procedure that is before you today. We then met again to talk about that draft of that procedure, and during those discussions, it became evident that the Amusement Association did have concern with the potential cost that would be involved, and that possibly the volume of the games that would be certified. In the working of that procedure, we did consult with what is called GLI Testing Labs. GLI Testing Labs is a world-renowned lab. They are the largest in the industry, in the gaming industry. They do and have said that they work with the industry, the Amusement Association industry, and other jurisdictions to do this similar type of work, so that they do certify games. We asked them if they believe that based on our statutory construct, based on what we were asking them to do, that could they certify that these games, let's say if we took one in particular that's been mentioned, Chug 21, we sent that to them, did it meet what would be defined as a casino style game? Could they take and certify that they're in their belief in the industry that it did not? And they said yes, that they could do that. We then took and said, okay, if that was the case and we received that certification back, what would we have to do as a state to take and be able to have an ability to then take and make an interpretation that would give that affirmative defense? And Herb Lovejoy worked on that in drafting up the procedure, and I'll let him speak to that as well. This does happen in the industry. Ours would be a little bit unique because, again, of our statutory construct, but the Gaming Labs does do this. Now, the Gaming Lab does this also for jurisdictions in the gaming industry themselves. They're very familiar, and they do this extensively for any style, any game that you see on any current slot machine. If you go down to Vegas, any type of game that you see on the VLTs as far as the Oregon Lottery, they take and certify games based on what the industry says that those games need to operate by and how they need to operate. So they're very familiar with that process, and they're able to do that process. Ultimately, as has been noted, that we could not reach an agreement as far as that this process would work for the amusement industry, and they would elect to go back and ask the legislature to take and work through the statutory construct to satisfy what their needs are. So that's as far as my testimony. I'll be glad to take any questions. I can ask Herb Lovejoy to kind of talk about the actual particular of the draft process if you'd like to hear that.
Good morning, Chair Cruz, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Herb Lovejoy. I'm Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm the legal representative for the Oregon State Police, and I'm here in my capacity as the legal representative of the Oregon State Police to basically talk about the legal aspects of the gray machine statutes and kind of flesh that out. Just as a preliminary matter, I'm here in my legal capacity to talk about the law. The Oregon Department of Justice has not formulated a policy decision or indicated a policy decision on the merits or non-merits of changing the gray machine statutes. I'm here just simply to talk about the law. What I wanted to start out talking about is the distinction and why there is this Class C felony for gray machine possession versus Class A misdemeanor possession for a gambling device. And that really goes back to, I'm a fan of legislative history, because if you're going to amend a statute, you really need to know why the statute evolved. And so if you go back to 1991, it really was in the genesis of the lottery system. and the insidious nature, if you will, of gray games versus gambling devices. A gambling device is fairly simple, and it's one of those things you know on site. A slot machine, you know exactly what that is. You take a look at an electronic terminal that has a payout or cash out button. That's a gambling device. But what's more insidious is the gray games. The gray games being where it emulates or simulates some sort of casino-style game. It doesn't necessarily have a payout button, but there's the possibility that behind the scenes, that kind of game, the owner of that kind of game, or the person who's in charge of that kind of game, is paying out behind the scenes. And I believe the legislative history between 1989 and 1991 bears out that that fear was founded in the back alley payments, if you will, for these types of gray games where the machine itself's not paying out, but the people behind the machines were. And so back in 1991, when the possession of the gray game statutes were enacted by the legislature and the Class C felony designation was put on it, the Oregon Department of State Police, along with the Department of Justice, did a study, talked to the people in Canada, talked to Nevada, talked to New Jersey about gray games in particular, and there was a very big concern about gray machines, that A, they were being continued to be used in Canada particularly, that gray machines were in areas accessible by the public, that it was difficult to prevent operators that were engaged in unlawful gambling from participating in the lottery system, and that operators not, at that time, the operators that had these types of machines were not providing assistance in eliminating the gray games. Coupled with what was basically deemed a decision that the security of the lottery system in Oregon should reside exclusively with the legislature and specifically with the Lottery Commission, that's kind of the genesis of the 1991 enactment of the gray game possession Class C felony statute. And again, other jurisdictions had similar stories about gray games. Nevada was contacted, they had the same thing. And so that was the genesis of it. If you take a look specifically at Oregon's version of the law and what gray games machines, where the rubber is meeting the road in this particular issue, is the words plays, emulates, or simulates a casino game, bingo, or keno. And it's emulates or simulates a casino game. And by statute, the legislature has defined what a casino game is. And it's the typical things that you would normally think of when you go to Nevada or Atlantic City and you walk across a casino floor. The traditional games of Texas Hold'em or roulette or that sort of things. But it's an all-encompassing definition. It's or any other gambling-based game similar in form or content. And so when you're talking about amusement devices, it is possible that the majority of the games on those devices do not meet the definition of a gray game because they're not emulating or simulating a casino-style game, but it is possible that they do have one or two or three or however many types of games that they do emulate or simulate a casino-style game. And that's really the difficulty in trying to create a carve-out to the gray game machine statutes and definitions in saying amusement devices aren't, when you've got to cover and you've got to address the issue of the emulate and simulate a casino-style game. And so that's where the legal issue is in all of this.
For either one of you, I can remember for a Christmas gift a couple of years ago, I was given a little, you could play poker on it, you could play roulette, you could play anything you want on it. If I've got it as a private individual, I guess that's okay, but if I took that same machine, the same thing, into a bar and they were charging me 25 cents to play it, where are we?
It's It's a good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I think personal possession of that, trying to track that, that's not in a public premises. But if you've got someone in a public premises that you're paying 25 cents to use that, then that may trigger the gray game machine statute and the possession.
You had mentioned that, I guess, inferring back alley payouts or something of that. Do we have any numbers about how much of this is going on, how many people have been apprehended, arrested, and how many prosecutions there's been?
Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, in that question, what I can tell you is that just as recently as March, I sat on a panel down in Las Vegas of regulators that were from the country, and it was specifically to this issue. It was the gray machine issue. And what I can tell you is that those panelists looked to Oregon and Oregon's law as what they would want. And the reason for that is that they have an explosion of these devices, just exactly what we're talking about, but they don't have the simulates or emulates a casino-style game. They would love to have that. And the reason they would love to have that is because even though there's not the hard meters in these machines anymore, when you can do free play on these games, and those free plays then, if a proprietor so chooses to take and develop a play table, they can develop a play table behind the scenes, and they can take and have the illegal gambling that was so prevalent prior to the 1991 statute. That is the reason why when that was written, and the report was done, which Attorney Frohnmayer at that time and the superintendent, Reg Mattson, at that time, did the report that Herb is talking about, recommended to the commission and ultimately to the legislature to enact that prohibition on the gray machines. I can take and ask the industry, and I can develop a white paper and give you more statistics of what they're experiencing with just these type of machines. Here in Oregon, right now, because that within the question came from Representative Hicks, we have 16 detectives that currently are contracted at the Oregon Lottery to take and do the security that is involved within that organization. Under that, there is actual statutory language that we are to enforce the gray machine statute. That's part of the construct that we're required to enforce. In that, specifically, do we go out and actually have specific detectives that go out and enforce that just solely, enforce that? No. Do they enforce that as part of their overall duties? Yes. Are we taking and going and actually doing investigations, which would require us to take and go in and sit and look and see, and it would require a different type of effort in the enforcement to be those type of investigations. We're not currently doing that. What we're looking for right now is the actual, are we seeing like Chug 21 emulates a casino-style game on these machines and enforcing the gray machine statute in that regards. But what I can tell you, Co-Chair Krieger, is that I was told by many different regulators that they're experiencing a very severe problem of illegal gambling due to these machines that have casino-style games on in their jurisdiction. So,
Mr. Schaffer?
Thank you, Mr. Wright. I think the operative term here is if there's a payout, you can't do that. That's against the law. You can't do that. And these machines sit there innocently on the bar. You have to have enough money going in to have a payout. They're putting a quarter in. The bar owner isn't going to come over and look, I got a 21. They're not. There's just no printout. There's no money coming out the slot. That, I think, is the distinction. You can have an illegal card game in the back room of your house if you want to. I mean, I know you don't have the resources to go look for that. And God bless you once again. I'm not against you guys. I'm grateful for the service you're providing. But these machines sit there right on the bar. And they put quarters in there. I don't think there's enough money going into the machine to have a payout. Nor I think it just logistically doesn't work. Now, do we want people to not gamble illegally? By the way, one could make a good argument that it's criminal how much money we take away from gamblers on legal machines in this state. I remember a statistic some time ago. The profit we make off of the Oregon Lottery is equal to the amount that problem gamblers are pouring into the machine. So we're hooked on this money, and we're continuing to enable people with problems to their life just goes right down the hole. But once again, these machines sit there on the bar just like this. I've never been in anywhere where I see they're paying out, and they're not going to pay out on these specific machines. And if they do, that's already illegal. I think the difference is, Mr. Chair, we should make it very clear. Any bar that has machines that aren't legal, and I'll let you know, that aren't run by the Oregon Lottery or Native American casinos, that pay out in cash or coin, or print out a ticket that says, here, you won, that, I think, is the distinction right there. Because there isn't enough money going into these machines for a bar owner to pay out, and logistically, it just doesn't make any sense to even try it. I'm not against these guys. They're out there enforcing the laws that this body imposed on this state. But this making criminals out of these guys over some stupid quarter game, and once again, a pinball machine pays out in a winning game if you're good enough. Does that mean they're gray machines? I mean, maybe they're exempt under the law. I don't know. There has to be a simple solution to this, Mr. Chair, and I don't have anything more to say about it. We've got to do one. Shut up.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I first want to start by apologizing to you. I think it's incumbent on the legislature to write laws that are clear and easy to understand. This isn't one. And so I think we need to sharpen our pencils and do a better job, and hopefully we can get that done. But the second sort of question for the counselor, I'm with you. I like to look at the legislative history. I want to know how we got here and why. And can you, this may be a stupid question, but that's all right. I'm not embarrassed. Can you describe for me what is the harm that we are specifically trying to prevent with this law?
The specific harm that was trying to be targeted was, first off, money laundering. Secondly, was to prevent organized crime to come into the state through what is basically a back door. They would not be able to get to the actual Oregon Lottery VLTs, but through some other device, some other type of device that is being paid out, not necessarily from the machine, but behind the scenes. And so it's kind of that type of thing. And then the third one was because of those fears and because of the Oregon Constitution provisions creating the Oregon Lottery, that to centralize and to basically lock down the security of the lottery and make sure that the security of the lottery was not vested in any part whatsoever in private operators.
And Representative Juan, members of the committee, if I could respond to that as well. Back, and we testified to this the last time we spoke about this as well, but back prior to 1991 when the video lottery was authorized, there was a fairly large proliferation of illegal gambling because of these type of machines. And at the time, these machines had a meter inside, what's called a hard meter, where you could take an ad of the credits, and the credits then developed the pay table, and also they had casino-style games on there. And there was also pay tables developed on another way as well. But 35 of the 36 counties in Oregon said no. That we will not, we do not want video lottery because we already have this large illegal gambling happening. Then the report was done that Herb has referenced as far as they looked around the industry, made a report and recommendation to the Lottery Commission, said one of the key hinges needed to be the gray machine provision, and that was put into place, and then the counties, as far as there were other things as well, but then it passed in 1991, and that went through. Now, since that time, fast forward, these machines have evolved to where they don't have the hard meters inside them. They don't have those meters, those electronic meters inside them. Okay, so that take, as far as the one provision of the gray machine statute, but you have the plays, emulates, simulates. What Representative Schaffler has described as far as that these machines sitting up there with just the plays, emulates, that's what's in these jurisdictions currently. That I know from speaking to the regulators, and again, I can provide the information. I don't have it to speak to exactly right now. But this is what the machines that they have, that they're currently experiencing, the type of illegal gambling activity that we were experiencing pre-91. Racketeering, money laundering, payouts, those type of things. How that, I could take and provide that information, I can get that information for you if you would like, but they are experiencing that. That is the concern that currently, that if we just have, you can walk in and play poker, you can play 21, you can play those type of things. Is there a possibility, as long as you have free play, and you can add up the free plays to take and develop a pay table, is there, now if you didn't have any type of free play, and you just put your dollar in, you got 10 plays, and that's what you got, that potentially could eliminate the issue. So, but that is the concern.
Just one final, and I thank you for your indulgence. I guess where I'm trying to get at with this is it's kind of like trying to fight dog fighting by banning all pit bulls. Okay, we're criminalizing an action. Okay, but the way to get at that is by going after a machine, and that doesn't seem to make much sense to me. When it's not the machine itself that you're describing as the problem, you're describing the payout on the back end. The machines may or may not have, you know, the opportunity to do that, but it is the action that we ought to be focused on and not this machine, which could be perfectly legal and not harmful to society in any respect. Thank you, Mr. Gosher.
Well, two questions. Yes, Representative Krieger, members of the committee. Mr. Martin mentioned the seizure of machines of his clients and then the decision not to prosecute. What's the legal basis for holding those machines now if there's no prosecution?
The legal basis is that they basically constitute contraband. If they in fact are a gray machine, they constitute contraband.
Was there a civil commitment proceeding?
And again, most of the counties, the district attorneys are out operating as county council are operating as the county's forfeiture council. And it's not the state police who has the ability or the legal authority to force a forfeiture action. It's the county council. It's usually the DAs who are the ones that are in the driver's seat as far as that. And so these machines sit. If the DAs are not prosecuting them on the criminal side and refuse to go forward on the forfeiture side, then they still are contraband, and so they sit.
But but no one legally has made a determination that they're a gray machine, and that's in dispute, right? There's been no judicial determination that they
correct.
Are a gray machine.
That's correct.
But nonetheless, they're being kept.
Right, and that's part of when a law enforcement officer sees a crime, they need probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, not an actual judicial determination. And so if they see a machine that appears to have a casino-style or a device that is emulating or simulating a casino-style game, then it meets the definition of a gray machine. It's illegal to have it. It's contraband, and it's subject to immediate forfeiture.
So you're saying the police officer mainly saying that it's a gray machine then gives you the right to keep it forever with no judicial determination?
No, what I'm saying is that it's by statute, it is contraband. And so there has, again,
but a judge
because
makes
of contraband, the legislature
right?
has said the person can't get it back.
The judge makes a determination if it's contraband.
If
the judge has not made the determination.
If there is a process for that.
Kept.
If there is a process for that. Currently there isn't. And if the committee members will turn to page 2 and 3 of the materials that were handed out by the Oregon State Police, one of the things that I made clear in the work group, and I think I need to make clear from a legal standpoint here, is that regardless of whatever policy decisions is made, and I'm not gonna comment on what policy decisions should or shouldn't be made, the statutes have to be changed. They, in order to do whatever it is that the legislature wants, they have to be changed. The first one is that the definition of gray machine has to be changed if, in fact, you're going to carve out some sort of definition for an amusement device, whether it's certified by the state police or whether or not some other mechanism is going to determine what an amusement device is, the legislature or an independent body. Secondly, you're going to have to modify and amend the defense to possession of gray machine under 167.194 to allow amusement device possession. You're going to have to, and then depending on whether or not you're going to vest Oregon State Police with the ability to do the certification, recertification of these machines as amusement devices and therefore exempt from the gray machine statutes, you'll have to give the state police rulemaking authority. And then on the top of page 3 is, there's a process for gambling devices, but there isn't a counterpart to gray machines as far as streamlining the process for How does a person go about challenging an initial seizure for possession that when the machine is seized because there's an allegation it's a gray machine? And what do you do with the judicial review provisions of that? And how do you expedite destruction of truly non-compliant machines? And so I think that's one of the things that the committee should look at. If in fact that's where you want to go with this amusement device, but there, the other parts definitely have to be changed in order to address this amusement device. From a legal standpoint, that has to happen.
Okay. Chairman of the committee, Mr. Lovejoy, once again, if there's been no judicial determination, there's an issue and dispute here whether it's a gray machine. Your police officers did their job, but their machines are sitting in limbo land that is their property. And yet, what's their recourse? You've effectively taken their property without giving them judicial recourse.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, that is an issue that we're running into. Once we seize evidence as evidence in the potential commission of a crime, once we've done that and it goes into evidence, then at that point we cannot dispose, remove, do anything with that evidence until we have some type of judicial action. And that's one of the things that we have to then go back to the courts and receive that from the court or the district attorney. And until we receive that, then we cannot do anything with that evidence as law enforcement.
Because nothing happens, they don't get their property back.
Well, co-chairs, Mr. Taylor, what I would also mention is that in the criminal process, there is a provision in the law, I believe it's in Chapter 136, to go to court and ask a circuit court for a motion to return things seized if, in fact, there's an allegation that the person is a rightful owner and that the material, whatever it is that's seized, should be returned. It may make more sense, again, this is a policy decision, to put that kind of procedure specific to gray machines in the gray machine statutes. But there is a provision that allows an individual who thinks the property was wrongfully seized to go into a circuit court and obtain judicial review of that. So that does exist in current law now.
And we could put something in there that said if there's no prosecution in 180 days, the seizing authority will return the machine.
You could do that. You could also say if, in fact, it's a gray machine and you want to continue with the concept of it being contraband, the counterpart would be within 180 days, the machine is destroyed. So that is something that can be done. It's just simply what is the policy determinations of the legislature.
Representative Schaffer?
Chair, these folks are just stuck. Everybody here before is just stuck. And unless this body acts, nothing's going to happen. But if I remember right, the game 31 was also considered emulate. 31 is in every single machine. You don't even have to put a quarter in. You can just do the menu like this. And it's in every single machine I've seen. Every single one. And none of them have the ability to pay out. There's no printout. There's no record. The meter you talk about, there's no way. It'd be impossible. And by the way, I know some really nice people. My mother-in-law owns a slot machine. I believe that is illegal that is contraband in this state underneath the current laws. One of the members on the Business and Labor Committee in 2011 told me he owns two of them. Oh, now you know the gender, so that narrows it down. But, it's just, so I don't want to beat up on you guys. You're doing your job, and God bless you for doing it. I'm honored that you're serving my state, but this is a real mess, and I pray to God you folks can figure it out.
We have gone over a considerable amount of time. I want to have Roger get together with Mr. Taylor. Representative Wand has showed some interest, as has Representative Hicks. Do you want to take part in that?
No.
Okay. Perhaps between now and December you can have a meeting or two and say, hey, what's possible that hasn't been explored already, and get back to the chairs prior to that meeting. In December. Just a second. We're not going to bring anyone else up to testify. We're way over. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming in.
Thank you.
Do have an impossible job.
It's unbelievable.
And we're going to end the Judiciary Committee today. The Senate's not here, so we'll do it for them.